Sitting of Parliament, Monday, 23rd of December 2013. Answers to all questions continue. And we're now going to proceed to the questions which are being posed to the Minister for Health and the Environment. Question 811 of 2013, the Honourable Mrs. Aimee Lohannan.
Mr. Speaker, further to question number 598, can the Minister for Health say when the DHA complaints process will be taken over by the Ombudsman and at what stage they are in the process?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, there is no definite date yet. Advanced drafts of the procedure are currently under discussion.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister say if there will be a U-turn on government's unfulfilled commitment that complaints will be dealt with directly by the Office of the Ombudsman?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think that is a logical implication of what I have just said. The question was when the complaint process will be taken over by the Ombudsman. And I have said there is no definite date and advanced draft of the procedure are currently under discussion. That does not contradict the government's manifesto commitment that the process will be taken over by the Ombudsman. It's a question of how and how it's going to be implemented, but there is no change in that policy.
Question 812, the Honourable Mrs. Aimee Lohannan.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain what the DHA policy for the recruitment and retention of staff is and what the terms for contract workers are wishing to apply for permanent and pensionable status?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, staff are initially appointed in contract terms and these may be a variable length depending on the specialism or post, and they may have a contract renewed or extended depending on the circumstances prevailing at the time. On the completion of 4 years of performance, where there is no locally qualified or eligible person studying, training or available for the post, or where no succession plan candidate has been identified, staff on contract terms may be offered indefinite employment.
Mr. Speaker, can I just say if rolling over 10-month contracts is legal as per EU employment with law? Would you know that?
I don't think that is a logical supplementary to the question that I have just answered, and therefore I don't think I need to reply.
Mr. Speaker, can I just say who decides on the terms and conditions and the length of the contract of new DHA staff?
Terms and conditions will be standard, and the length of contract will depend, as I said in the answer, depending on the specialism of pay and what the succession plan may or may not be. There are no two cases which are the same, and there will be different line managers who are responsible for taking those decisions.
But Mr. Speaker, can I just confirm it's the line managers to make those decisions, not the Human Resources Department, or is it a conjunction with the Human Resources Department?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very proud to say that the Water Health Authority certainly now works with the team, and when decisions have to be taken which have a bearing on performance and employment, they will involve the managers in question and the Human Resources Department. In some occasions, I may be involved, but usually I will not be.
Question 813, the Honourable Mrs. Aimee Lohannan.
Speaker, can Minister for Health say when the 25% gratuity offer in view of permanent and pensionable status was removed from the contract of DHA contract workers?
answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the 25% of the offer in your permanent competitive status was removed on the 1st of January 2012, following the ending of the old pension scheme by the last administration.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say what has replaced it?
The Provident Pension Scheme, which was the one that replaced the old pension scheme. The superannuation, the Provident, I think it is. I mean, I don't have that information. I've answered the Provident 2 and the superannuation. I am informed by my colleague.
So the superannuation fund is a policy of your government, not a policy of our government. Did I understand the Honourable Minister correctly? Did he say that the policy had changed as a consequence of changes that we've introduced to the pension system? Because the superannuation fund was something that was introduced by, sorry, I may have misunderstood you.
What I said was that gratuities were removed when the old pension scheme was removed. Gratuities were given because the old pension scheme was not available to short-term contract officers, and when that scheme was done away with, gratuities were done away with because they are now able to join the pension scheme.
Can the Minister tell me whether people's contracts have been affected retrospectively? In other words, whether this has been something that has been introduced for future employees, respecting contracts, for example, of consultants that have been on this 25% of their gratuity?
This is for new entrants, so people who have a contract are bound to a contract.
Question 814, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say why there has been a reduction in the housing allowance for GHA contract workers and whether this financial incentive will be removed entirely from the contract of GHA contract workers and if so, when?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, there has been no reduction in the housing allowance given to GHA contract workers. And there are no current plans to remove this.
Speaker, can the Minister say what is the GHA policy on housing allowance for contract workers?
Speaker, at the moment there is a housing allowance given to contract workers. That's the current situation. That's what I've just said.
Question 815, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say why the Director for the GHA Human Resources and the Executive Director for Strategic Development are no longer in employment at the GHA and how much they are each given for terminating their employment contract?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
The Speaker, the Executive Department from the GHA was by mutual agreement. The terminal payments were in accordance with the contract that they had been given by the former administration and amounted to approximately 107 and 109,000 for human resources and strategic development posts respectively.
Question 816, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say how many applicants there were for the vacant post of district nurse in charge nurse and who was successful in getting the job?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, there were three applicants. It would not be correct to publicly state the names and my honourable and learned friend, the Minister for Equality, Social Services and the Elderly, pointed out on Thursday that this is in keeping with the Speaker's ruling.
Um, Mr. Speaker, have all three applicants been successful or just one chosen from the three?
Mr. Speaker, the three applicants were successful.
Mr. Speaker, why were the extra two vacancies, why were they not advertised separately at a later date when the original vacancy advert was for only one cardinal?
Mr. Speaker, this came at a time when management decided that it was appropriate for the specific post to be at that level, and it followed the procedure established in 2006 by the former administration when a vacancy for one post had been advertised, but management decided that two should be taken, and in order not to delay things further and to require the whole process to start anew, the selection procedure was extended to include those. So there is no change in established practice.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say why a change in decision was made to move the employment from just the one charge nurse to now three charge nurses?
As I explained, Mr. Speaker, this was as a result of the management of the section feeling that that is a more appropriate way in which to run this highly specialised section, and if people are working largely independently but carry a large amount of responsibility on their shoulders.
Mr. Speaker, is the government now going to increase or double the number of community nurses to commensurate with the doubling of the charge nurses in the community, and if so, by when?
Mr. Speaker, there is no current plan. As with all other matters in the GHA, we are constantly reviewing how we carry out our operations, but there is no current plan at the moment.
Mr. Speaker, does not the Minister agree that by having changed this decision at the last minute by management, by increasing, by offering employment to these three charge nurses after the issue of a vacancy notice for just one post, that other GHA staff may have been disadvantaged by not providing them with the opportunity to apply?
No, sir, the Minister does not agree. And as I say, this is the practice which was following established practice dating back to 2006. Maybe it happened then, but certainly I do not agree that it happened now.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm that one of the successful applicants had, prior to the announcement of the vacancy, gone to the UK to undertake a course as a child manager for the community nurses and decided not to complete the course, and then later was taken on as a successful applicant?
Mr. Speaker, I am not aware of those circumstances.
Speaker, could I ask the Minister whether the decision to appoint the three applicants, was that decision taken by the board who's thinking the three applicants, or was it taken by the different sets of people above the individuals in that particular board?
Speaker, the board is a board which selects its applicants, and we have, I have to assume, found all three suitable. That is the only assumption I can make. Otherwise, they clearly would not have been appointed.
Well, Speaker, he makes the assumption that there would have been a decision of the board, but yet he doesn't know. But he doesn't know either the fact that one of the applicants went to the UK to undertake that called trial preparation, and he doesn't know that he's even decided not to complete the course either. It seems to me that the Minister for Health very conveniently chooses to ignore and assume things he doesn't put him in a bad light, and they take decisions not answering questions here in Parliament. Is it not the fact that the person that he knows, because he does know, that went to the UK to undertake such a call, decided not to do it, got the job now in the interim board, because it happens to be an acting GSP member?
The honourable members of the opposition make themselves responsible for the information that they are imparting.
I think that that is a surprising question from the speaker.
It is what?
With respect, it is a surprising question because the opposition always takes responsibility for the accuracy of the point that they make. This line of questioning is obviously a line of questioning with a purpose. And I think that Mr. Speaker, unless Mr. Speaker has some official evidence that we do not know what we're talking about, I don't believe that Mr. Speaker ought to be making that point.
So it happens that Mr. Speaker is the chairman of the Public Service Commission. I will say nothing further on the matter. I am just saying that it is a principle enshrined in the rules, and which I am glad to hear from what the leader of the opposition says, that honourable members of the opposition make themselves responsible when they give information along the lines of the information that we have heard today. I'm glad to hear that they make themselves responsible, and that therefore, in their view, that information is accurate. That is all I want to say.
Absolutely, we make this study, we hold ourselves responsible for the accuracy. This is the first time I have been a member of this House for, since 2007. I'm not the oldest member of this House, but it's the first time that I've ever heard a speaker make a point like that about accuracy when my honourable colleagues are pursuing a line of questioning on the basis of information that they have. We would never, nobody in the opposition would be asking any questions if we do not make ourselves responsible for the accuracy. And Mr. Speaker has information that casts doubt on the accuracy of our line of questioning. Well, look, he can tell us that our line of questioning is inaccurate because he sits in the Public Service Committee and he knows it's inaccurate. But I doubt very much that Mr. Speaker can actually go that far.
I am making the point because the information that has been imparted to members of the opposition is apparently not available to the minister.
Speaker, if I may just comment, the implication from the honourable member is that I misled Parliament. I have no knowledge of any course taken or not taken by the applicant. I believe that. What I do know is that three successful applicants are extremely good professionals, every single one of them. Whether or not they are activists of any particular political party is not relevant to whether they are good masters or not. And I can assure you, Mr. Speaker, that if that vote selected them, they are excellent masters. And I can confirm it is a board which was referred to the Public Service Commission, and therefore is completely out of any influence of me as a minister.
Speaker, can the Honourable Minister inform this House as to when the decision to go from one to three charge nurses was a decision that was taken before the recommendation of the Board and after the advert, or was it after the recommendation of the Board?
Speaker, I haven't got the timeline in front of me. I have answered the question I've asked, how many applicants and who were successful. I've answered part one because I can. I cannot answer part two. I don't have a timeline in front of me, so I cannot answer that question.
Mr. Speaker, but of course, as the minister responsible, doesn't it agree with me that it's rather odd that here we have a highly specialized world. Those are the words that you use in answer to my honourable friend, Mr. Galeen Hammond. Now, bear in mind that this is a highly specialized service. And he being a thorough minister, I know that he is, I mean, I have a respect for him, that in a planning situation, in a highly specialized service, this is not a rule, but it is odd that we have a situation whereby there is an advert for one charge nurse, and lo and behold, at some stage, we don't know when, whether it's before the recommendation of the Board or after the recommendation of the Board, it then goes from one to three people being taken on. This is not a rule, but at the very least, what it illustrates is a lack of planning in relation to a highly specialized service, as you have just
on the conference of the speaker. I think it shows that one is able to take advantage of situations, and if as the election process was ongoing, then that is an opportunity to be taken as connected relations. And it is absolutely identical, I repeat, Mr. Speaker, except that instead of an addition from 1 to 3, it is 1 to 2, an identical situation which arose back in 2006, which nobody batted an eyelid about. So there is no precedent. This is something which has happened before.
Well, Mr. Speaker, yes, I don't dispute that in the past there may have been a situation where there has been, after the recommendation of the board, the report, for example, is recommended, and there are two people that are highly, that are very, very good for this particular post, and there is a policy decision taken at that stage to take two people. But it is very, very unusual, and what we have here is an advert that's gone out for one, and then ultimately three are taken on. One always gets very good quality, high quality applicants, because the nature of our civil service is the fact that there are very good people. But one would have thought that in a highly specialized service such as this one, that it would have been effectively at demand led from the very beginning. One looks at, well, what do we need for this highly specialized service? Do we need one, two, or three? Here the decision has been taken, but we need one. And then ultimately, we don't know when the decision was taken, whether before the recommendation of the board or afterwards. It's then three. Doesn't the Honourable Minister think that is unusual?
It's unusual in the sense that it happens twice. But it's not the first time it happened. But nevertheless, it is an opportunity, clearly, that the management took in order to be able to improve the service and take advantage of the fact that the procedure was already in motion.
Question 817, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lord-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say who's dealing with the negotiating consultant's contract and at what stage of progress are we in the process?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the DHO is negotiating with Unite the Union as they represent the majority of consultants. The negotiations are going well.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm that John Lanyon and Ernest Lima are still dealing with the negotiation and consulting contract?
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Lanyon and Mr. Lima are dealing on behalf of the DHA with the negotiations of the consulting contract. And let me just add that they both finished their term when Mr. Lanyon, who was the interim chief executive, Mr. Lima was an advisor, and Mr. Lanyon has continued leading because he committed himself when he took on the job to complete these negotiations. But since he finished at the end of August, he has been doing this on a pro bono basis.
Mr. Speaker, it seems that the negotiations for this contract has been for over a year and a half. When will it be completed?
When an agreement is reached, Mr. Speaker.
Question 818, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lord-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, with reference to the Government Press Release number 861 of 2013, can the Minister for Health say how sexual health will be promoted in addition to the Minister's plans to publish HIV and AIDS statistics?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the Public Health Department has developed a health improvement strategy for Gibraltar, which includes sexual health as one of its key priorities for the next 2 years. The following are some of the initiatives that will be progressed within this program area. One, supporting education and sex and relationships, about sex and relationships with schools and youth sex settings. Two, providing access to good quality advice for all persons on sexuality, family planning, and sexually transmitted diseases. Three, campaigning to reduce the prevalence of teenage pregnancies in our community. for supporting the establishment of a nurse-led sexual health clinic, 5 encouraging access to HIV and STD testing for people who may be at risk, 6 improving the collection of anonymized local data to inform sexual health strategies, 7 producing relevant printed materials. In this, the DHA will continue to work with community groups such as the Equality Rights Group, with which regular meetings have been held during the past 2 years.
Question 819, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Lord-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister for Health said in his budget statement of 2013 that the new mental health unit would be ready in October or November. Can the Minister advise when the facility will now be opening?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the unit has been subject to a delay typical of the construction industry and is now due to open in spring 2014.
Question 820, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Lord-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, service to written question number 135 of 2013, can the Minister for Health say, A, why there are no figures for April 2012 and June 2013, and B, why the cost for sending patients to Zanet have more than doubled per month since September 2013?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, there are no figures for April 2012 and June 2013 because the bills for the month in question were paid on the following month. The cost for sending patients to Denmark have increased because a number of procedures that used to be referred exclusively to UK are now performed in Denmark. This reduces inconvenience to families who are travelling to UK and makes visiting relatives easier. The increase in referrals to Zanet has also coincided with a decrease in referrals to Spanish state hospitals due to long waiting times currently existing in the Spanish Servicio Andaluz de Salud system, which have worsened recently. In addition to this, there have sadly been a number of exceptional cases this year which have involved long stays and expensive care.
Thank you for that, Mr. Speaker. Can the Honourable Minister say then, if the service that was offered in the UK has now been is being offered at Zanet, has there been also a reduction in the payment through the Department of Health for this sponsored patient service as a consequence of the increase in payments to Zanet?
So, Mr. Speaker, if we're spending the money in Zanet, that money will not be spent in the UK. However, because of the fact that this is totally unpredictable, there could be other cases going to the UK, and therefore you won't necessarily see a corresponding decrease. What there has been is a considerable decrease in referrals to other Spanish hospitals, particularly, as I said before, Spanish state hospitals, because of increasing waiting times, in particular, which have got worse. In recent months and over the past year. I can say, however, that whereas there is an increase in referrals to Zanet, the total number of referrals to Spain were slightly down in 2011, or the first 11 months of 2013 in relation to 2012. But this is something that isn't totally predictable. This is demand-led. And we are not going to refuse treatment to a deserving patient for reasons of this nature. But globally, I think I do have to point out one thing I said earlier, that it only takes one or two particularly difficult cases which have extensive care to make these figures rise considerably. It just may be one or two, so you cannot really relate it to number of patients.
Question 821, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Lord-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say if there is any truth in the rumour that a motorbike and its owner were transported in one of the new ambulances? And if so, can the Minister provide details to Parliament?
answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir. For the avoidance of doubt, it's what I mean is that there is no truth in the rumour, not that I cannot say so. There is no truth in that rumour.
Question 822, the Honourable Mrs. Ironman Lord Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the amendment to the Medical Health Act 1997 to provide for the compulsory registration of allied health professionals, can the Minister for Health say how the powers of UK governing bodies be transferred to the Gibraltar Registration Board for the overseeing and policing of the ongoing requirements health professionals need to meet?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the amendment of the Medical and Health Act of 1997 at long last establishes the Gibraltar Medical Registration Board as a regulatory authority for allied health professionals in Gibraltar. The law requires that the assessment of the qualifications and competence of the professionals is carried out by the respective UK regulator as not by the Gibraltar Board. Furthermore, any requirements laid by the UK regulator on maintenance of professional standards, continuous professional development or revalidation will be directly monitored by the UK regulator and impact upon Gibraltar only if registration is affected in consequence. The UK regulatory bodies, in addition, have powers to oversee and police their registrants wherever they may practice. The Gibraltar Medical Registration Board will play a supportive role in this function. Complaints or allegations of poor practice made to the Gibraltar Board regarding allied health practitioners practicing within Gibraltar will be investigated locally. And except where the complaints are wholly frivolous, the board will notify the respective UK regulator who may choose to invoke the fitness to practice procedure. Decisions arising from the procedure will be binding on the practitioner in the UK, and in as much as they impact on the practitioner's registration, by consequence, also in Gibraltar. In addition, the Act also provides the Gibraltar Board with a range of powers to take independent action, which would be binding on registered practitioners within the territory of Gibraltar.
Question 823, the Honourable J.J. Milton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Environment state we have discussed in our latest tool by the Minister at the Committee States of the Appropriation Bill 2013 regarding extending the duties carried out by Sarah to guns in relation to the culling of seagulls have now concluded and is going to provide partly with details of the agreement?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir, they have not been completed.
Could the Minister perhaps elucidate as to why they have not concluded any certain point in terms of coming to a final agreement? I do recall that his comments at the appropriation state, at the appropriation state, committee stage of the bill, the Minister was saying that his intentions were to absorb the work being carried out in the past by Sarah into Gong. So perhaps if you could elucidate as to what the sticking points in that discussion.
So, there are no sticking points. The discussion is still ongoing. It's a complex, but it's not a simple matter. And the department is dealing with it with a view to implementing by the time the spring comes, which is when these measures need to be more effective.
So, if the Minister envisages in a situation whereby after spring, Sarah will not carry out any further duties?
That is what I said at the time, and that continues the situation for the present.
So, in order to be able to carry out such duties in the future, will there be an extra amount of cost or the budget, the size of the budget for guns will increase accordingly?
the Speaker, the budget for the visit from Sarah. I think it's in the region in 1 year of close to 200,000, another year to 100,000, for people to come from abroad for 6 weeks to carry out work which local people were doing for much less over a period of the whole year. So therefore, there is no intention to follow that practice. The intention is to use the expertise that is available in a more economically efficient way. I do not believe that the cost will be equivalent, and certainly there will not be for a 6 week period, there will be for a 52 week period.
Will mean, therefore, an increase in the number of people dedicated in going for the calendar season.
Speaker, I'm not going to publicly conduct the negotiations with any organization here. We are looking at the way in which the work that was being done by Sarah are going to be done in the future. Some of the work being done by Sarah at the time probably didn't need to be done, as I expressed at the time, to the environment at the time, but I'm not going to go into details of discussions which are ongoing because it would compromise their outcome.
Question 824, the Honourable J. J. Neto.
Mr. Speaker, so this is a recent answer to question W136 of 2013. Can the Minister for the Environment say what has been the criteria for selecting the worst state of arms at the Dorf Park?
Answer the Honourable Minister of Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the area was selected on the advice of the Gibraltar Responsible Pet Owners Group. Presentation with the Gibraltar Heritage Trust and the Heritage Division confirmed that the proposed use was consistent with heritage. And this was later unanimously approved by the Development and Planning Commission.
Question 825, the Honourable J. J. Nicholl.
The Speaker, further to the answer given to question number 690 of 2013, is the Minister for the Environment aware that the Gibraltar Cat Welfare Society has been losing cats for some years now? And if so, does the Minister know how many cats have been saved on an annual basis?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am aware. I am informed that 59 cats have been used this year, but I have not got any more information.
Does the Minister perhaps know whether this particular program by the Cat Welfare Society will continue? Because when I looked at their own website, it didn't look to me like it was a function that was carried out every year. And as we discussed in the past here in Parliament, there is a need for a program of this nature to be carried out, particularly in certain areas of Gibraltar, and used to say in the Upper Rock Nature Reserve. So, can the Minister perhaps inform the House whether this program will continue to be featured either by them or perhaps if they are not doing it on a year-by-year basis by some other entity?
I think I'm currently in discussion with the Cat Welfare Society to see how this program can be continued.
Question 820.
Does the Minister have an idea of numbers of cats? Is there an effort to monitor the number of cats, the rising population or decreasing population of cats? I mean, he knows that I live in the Upper Rock, my children have already adopted 3 kittens, I can tell him, that have been abandoned. There appears to me to be an increase in the number of cats. I mean, I don't know, I'm just talking from my own experience of seeing them in the Upper Rock myself. But is there a conscious effort on the part of the government to basically monitor the numbers so that this particular problem can be kept on top of? Because, of course, as we all know, they're really wreaking havoc with the wildlife in the Upper Rock in particular.
We are attempting to monitor certain key areas to see whether we can have an idea of the cat population, but there are no data, so at the moment we can only guesstimate, but we are trying to monitor in the Upper Rock.
And the Speaker isn't satisfied that the neutering of the number of caps that they have used, I think he indicated 59, that is going to deal with the problem. And how long does he think that it will take before it will deal with and keep the population of caps within manageable proportions, and certainly within numbers that will not cause significant damage to wildlife and wetlands?
A figure provided by the Cat Welfare Society. It's not that the government has been, as far as I know, never has been, or the government has supported the Cat Welfare Society in carrying out this work. It hasn't done it directly. And 59 neutered cats will not solve the problem in the upper rock. So, no.
Just by way of providing information, I've just seen that from the Cat Welfare Society's website, from the report published in 2007, they say in a course over 3 years, it has had to sterilize and release 1,190 cats on the rock. So they have that some of the work is done in the past. My obviously concern is that kind of quality can be maintained, and some of the images are already provided by the minister.
Question 826, the Honourable J.J. Medlar.
The Speaker, so this will answer to question number 691 of 2013. Can the Minister for the Environment provide the monthly numbers of cats culled since the 11th of December 2011 as asked for but not given?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
The Speaker, the number was given as an average, which mathematically is the number of cats culled per month, and therefore the question was correctly answered. I now have to assume that rather than the monthly number, the Honourable Member wishes to know the number per month. This information is provided in the study on our handover.
The information may come now, just to point out that in case to my question of 691 is asked, the number of cats culled on a monthly basis. So I was right, and he's wrong interpreting my question, but I see the figures now.
I don't think I need to comment on that.
The number he's very kindly provided the schedule, and the culling appears to be really focused on 3 months in 3 months in 2013, 23 in July, 6 in August, 15 in September. Then there's two other figures, 2 for May, 3 for October, but the rest is zero, and there's a similar pattern. And also in 2012. Can you explain this particular pattern of why there doesn't appear to be an even spread over months? I mean, it does appear to indicate that really there is no systematic program spread over a year to deal with the question of feral cats by way of culling, which is one of the ways that obviously the government, rightly in our view, is dealing with this particular issue.
Mr. Speaker, we're talking about cats here in urban areas, and the way that this has been done in the past, and this was, I think, explained in my answer last time around, which, although it was converted to a written answer, there won't be a recollection of a discussion. I've been told the result of the contract dating back to 2005, but the way it's been operating for a number of years, is that the car has been activated by requests from the public complaining about fleas or some other problems, and it's been a result of that, and therefore when there's been a complaint, then the car has been activated, and therefore you will see this pattern that suddenly the race car is and then it stops again. The practice has been that it is it has been on the request of members of the community. Needless to say, there are those in the community who are not in favor of cows, and I obviously recognize that as well. But the explanation of these stop and start figures is that they are following requests from members of the public.
And Peter, I mean, there are two points that arise from the answer that the honourable gentleman has given. I'm very grateful for it. One of them is that these are cows that have taken place in urban areas. The second is that it is a response to a request from members of the public. Does he not agree with me that it does appear from that particular answer that really there is no systematic plan in terms of, or that culling doesn't form part of the government's plan to deal with the issue of feral cats in the Upper Rock, which he and I both recognise is wreaking havoc with wildlife, and in particular with an iconic species of the Delta, which is the Barbary Partridge? And can you explain why the issue of culling, or culling as a legitimate form of control of feral cats, hasn't been taken to the Upper Rock so we can control the cat population there?
Because I think we have to distinguish the situation in the Upper Rock with that in urban areas. And we must remember that there are those in urban areas who actually feed cats. You may agree or disagree with them, but they are there, the people who do that, and are very sensitive towards that. Something that, as I say, whether you agree with it or not, you have to recognize they are also members of our community. And the Upper Rock is a different issue. And the way that the Upper Rock is being tackled is initially, as I said earlier, by monitoring, trying to determine what the scale of the problem is, particularly in areas which are more likely to have Barbary Partridges, which is areas of more open ground rather than the dense vegetation. And we're trying to build up a picture using a number of systems which I can discuss later with the honourable member opposite, and to monitor, and then we hope to be developing a strategy to see how we tackle that so that the Barbary Partridge can be protected.
Can you give me a time frame in relation to this? Because we all recognise here that if we had a choice, we wouldn't cull cats. And that's the reality. We wouldn't cull cats if one had the choice. But in a situation where they are impacting heavily on wildlife in the Upper Rock in particular, something as important to Gibraltar as the Barbary Partridge, one would have thought that the government would have perhaps been slightly more energetic in its attempt to get on top of the problem. Yes, because there's a sizable population of feral cats in the Upper Rock. If you can give me a timetable of when he thinks that perhaps the government is going to be moving towards the Upper Rock in trying to cut down the population of feral cats in the Upper Rock that is causing such a problem with wildlife there.
We're in danger of having a really long discussion on Barbary Partridge management, and I'm happy to have that, but I don't know whether the rest of the members particularly want to hear it. There's a number of things here. Firstly, there is no way that no matter how much you do, you're going to remove the full population of feral cats on the Upper Rock. Therefore, you have to concentrate on those areas where you want the partridges to do well, which means you concentrate on the areas which are better habitat for the partridges. So what we are doing is we are creating new Barbary Partridge habitats. We are monitoring those areas. We are in the final stages of acquiring Barbary Partridges from Morocco, and we want to time it in such a way that when we release these partridges, we are actually not releasing breakfast for cats. So we are timing it quite tightly, and a lot of things have to slot in before we are ready to go.
So just following on from that, this is my last supplementary question on this. Effectively, the minister and business, in that very tight timetable for the acquisition and release of Babu cartridges, but when he releases those Babu cartridges, then he will have substantially dealt with the problem of feral cats in the areas where you're going to be releasing the cartridges. Bearing in mind as well, of course, that begs the question. I mean, you know, this is either you're not going to be releasing them in fenced out areas. So, if you have a very large population of feral cats in the upper off, they are bound to be moving, for example, to the area of Windmill Hill, where I presume that's one of the areas where you're going to be releasing some of these cartridges. But can you perhaps put some light in relation to that or give that guarantee to the House?
I sense the enthusiasm of the honourable member opposite, and I'm sure that behind the door he is extremely pleased that I happen to be Minister for the Environment. Mr. Speaker, I didn't hear that, but I'm sure it's quite funny. Mr. Speaker, the idea is that this will work and that we will be able to ensure the ongoing success of the Babu Party. It is a new success of the Babu Party, but I really think, Mr. Speaker, that from a question on monthly numbers of cats tied in urban areas, if I may add, to a discussion on the management of the Babu Party, probably with respect to the honourable member opposite, and I am very glad to know that he shares my keenness for the species, I think that's probably as far as we need to take it at this point in time.
Question 827, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Mr. Speaker, so what is the answer to question number 700/2013? Is the Minister for Environment not aware of the ESG community of the 16th of October 2013? In relation to the concerns of air pollution?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, yes, he is. Question 700/2013 asked whether the Department for the Environment had received reports of, and I quote, persistent heavy air pollution associated with recommends of sulfur snow. Mr. Speaker, it had not. It had received four isolated complaints, which is precisely what I answered.
Mr. Speaker, the EEC community of October 16th, they talked about the system heavy air pollution in the area of Waterford Terraces, the South District, and the port. They also talked about talking to the government, meaning probably the Minister for Environment, and talking to the Department of Environment in relation to raising investment funds on the persisting air pollution. Has the EEC now had that discussion with the Minister and the Department of Environment in relation to their concerns?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I have very regular contact with the ESG in relation to around about the time when the ESG issued their statement, which was on the 16th of October. There had been an approach, which I have recorded here on that day, from the ESG to the agency. The matter was relating to snows that had occurred on the previous day, so it was difficult to investigate that particular instance. There was subsequently a report the following day, not from the ESG, which was investigated, and it appeared that there was an issue with a ship that had come into port with ammonia. But ammonia that is more like resonant, so it was probably unrelated to the previous one. Certainly, I'm glad to say that the large space of snow related to bunkering, which happened a few years ago, hasn't happened, and these continue largely to be isolated incidents.
Question 828, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Mr. configure. Can the Minister for Environment say which pathways, green areas and walking routes in the Upper Ross Nature Reserve have been temporarily closed as a result of the comments made by the Minister of Heritage that the Heritage Trust ATM in which he stated or what he saw were, quote, desperate, unquote?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, as a result of continuing work to improve public access to the Upper Ross, works are ongoing in the Douglas Park Mount Misery area, and access to a section south of the cable car truck station has been closed off pending work. This information is about a week old, Mr. Speaker, and those works may have progressed since then. But if you remember, we adjourned from last Thursday, and I haven't had the opportunity to check this morning.
You know, just for the sake of telling people, is the Minister saying that this particular pathway he's referring to was closed about a week ago? Is that what he's saying?
Mr. Speaker, there has been ongoing work in Douglas Park and what is known as Mount Misery. Another section, which is south of the Cable Car Truck Station, which is the other peak, so to speak, north of Mount Misery, has been closed off pending work. It is those works that I'm not sure whether they have been carried out or not. The ones to Douglas Park and Mount Misery were ongoing when this answer was drafted. So they may well have been completed or will be nearing completed.
But in any case, I mean, what the Minister of Environment is referring to is one particular pathway which has been temporarily closed. The impression that the Minister for Heritage gave at the Heritage Trust ATM was that there were many green areas, pathways in the Upper Ross Nature Reserve which were desperate. That's the impression, at least, of course, in the press. The speaker, I know he's alluding to me. The fact is that what I said in the AGM, the Heritage Trust AGM, was that there was one place, and that is Mount Misery, which is what my colleague is just stating. And I can tell him for his peace of mind that I went the next day there with a health and safety officer, and that is the place which is now blocked off for safety reasons. There is no pathway, there is no other place. It was just one specific place, and that was blocked off, and it's still blocked off until work on our own.
Question 829, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Speaker, further to question number 694 of 2013, can the Minister for the Environment say what will be the waste disposal options that the government will embark upon the completion of the specialist report by Rumble in January 2013, providing a timeline for the implementation of such policies? Can I just add, Mr. Speaker, that my understanding is that I gave notice of the question, and the deadline for the notice of the question was on the 1st of the 12th of December, and I believe the government issued a press release on the 16th of December to the press, which is the thing that we're here, in a way that sort of puts the decision quite so difficult, because from time to ask questions for which already some of the answer may have been put on the and the public notice with the press.
Mr. Speaker, if I may answer that point first, we're talking about two separate documents. The question which I have and I am about to answer, 829, refers to a report by Rambo, which was a report on waste management options for Gibraltar. The waste management plan, which is the one that the Honourable Member referred to in his last comment, is the Waste Management Plan for Gibraltar, which is independent, totally independent, a completely different document, and it's an EU requirement that has to be published by a certain date, and we did meet the time frame. So it's a completely different document, and one is only to do with the other, in that we're both talking about waste, and that clearly, if we have commissioned a report in January to talk to us about waste options, clearly some of that will be reflected in the waste management plan. But it is certainly a completely different document, and in no way will one have affected the answer that I'm going to give you, which, as I may, I will not proceed to give the formal answer. Following completion of the waste treatment options assessment report undertaken by Rumbold in January 2013, government resolved to invite funders in the official journal of the European Union and local press for the design, build, finance and operation of a waste treatment facility. Government wishes to provide waste treatment facilities locally with the aim of achieving the highest environmental standards in the treatment of its municipal solid waste and urban wastewater treatment byproducts, tiles and other bulky items. Government principal requirements for the waste treatment facility are as follows. A waste reception, sorting and storing facility for specific and separate waste streams. A material recovery facility which will recover recyclable materials from the municipal waste stream. A waste treatment plant for which technologies of advanced thermal treatment would be considered. A facility capable of generating electricity and or producing potable water and or producing biodiesel and or producing syngas, handling and treatment of ad hoc waste, handling and treatment of saline sewage sludge. The tender was advertised on the 14th of February. The tender stage is now closed. Government is currently reviewing the tender submissions and will be in a position to make a decision in the first half of next year.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister for Environment have a timeline in relation to by when they would like to see, at least tentatively, in operation the new waste treatment plant?
I think as soon as possible. This is something that is well overdue and something that this government has taken on with great care. Clearly, we needed to have the consultant's assessment, which is the report that I referred to in January 2013. Then that was used to inform the tender process. The tender process is currently reaching its final stages. And I would like to think clearly it depends on what the different options are and what tender finally provided. But I would have thought that certainly within this term of government we should see the waste plant operation.
People think they might have lost the last part of the word for the oil and environment. Can you give an indication as to by when the new waste treatment plan will be operative?
As soon as possible. And my wish would be that it would be within this term of government. But certainly depends on the details of the selected tender.
So basically, it's not in a position right now to move whether it's in 12 months' time or 24 months' time. Can I also ask the Minister, what is the location as to where the waiting in plant might be located?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the intention is still to have it in the Governor's Cottage Park.
Is the Minister perhaps in a position to tell the House what percentage of electricity may be able to be produced by these waste treatment plants at this moment, or will have to wait for the completion
and possibly perhaps from the original question?
Question 830, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Can the Minister of Environment say which recommendations of the Atherhof Nature Reserve, a management and action plan, have been implemented since the 9th of December 2011, which ones the Minister intends to implement in the next 24 months, and which ones the Minister feels that will not be able to implement and why?
I'll say the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
The recommendations that will be implemented for the Upper Rock Nature Reserve and the wider Gibraltar Nature Reserve will all be fully laid out in the upcoming management plan that is being drafted by the Department of Environment in consultation with the relevant stakeholders. In any case, there are some notable recommendations that have been put into effect since 9th December 2011, which include extending the boundary of the nature reserve to include other important habitats such as the Great Sand Slope, Greenland Hill, Desert Flower, and Europa Point Forestry. 2. Clearing areas of dense vegetation within the reserve. 3. Appointing wildlife wardens. 4. Reviewing traffic flows in the Upper Rock as part of the traffic management plan. 5. Establishing a cave working group along with monitoring cave biodiversity and protecting specific caves and tunnels in the Upper Rock by means of grills and fences. 6. Facilitating and supporting the monitoring of bat populations in Gibraltar as part of the Good Bat Project. This has already resulted in a new species of bat being recorded in Gibraltar, namely the Isabelline Serapine Bat. 7. Improving parks in the Upper Rock. And 8. Continued removal of invasive species.
Question 831, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Can the Minister of Environment say if there are any prominent plans to avoid having Babri Macaque enter into mangrove area in the near future?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
As a speaker, management and staff of Mangrovenia have been invested in what measures they should take to discourage the mangroves. This includes ensuring staff and visitors do not provide food, making bins monkey-proof, and dealing with the scaffolding that has been in place for years.
You see, the thing is that, well, the scaffolding has been there for many years. It is the case that the macaques are venturing into their homes more often into lots of veterans of the residents there in Mangrovenia in frequent numbers, particularly lately. And it's why all the measures that the Minister has announced just now are possibly steps in the right direction. It may not defeat the fact that Mangrovenia continue to get inside the veterans of the residents. And for that particular aspect of the question, does the Minister not see that perhaps the staff in Mangrovenia might need some extra help or resources in conjunction with either the Department of Environment or perhaps some other entities?
The speaker, they are getting that. They are getting regular visits from the Macaque team and being encouraged and advised on how to deal with it. So that is happening. There is constant contact. The monkeys were attracted initially to fruiting trees in the gardens of the monks and then discovered the bins, and apparently people started to put food out for them, which is clearly something that we must all discourage. And so the situation is being handled with the support of the team.
Question 832, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Several clients have been to question 696 of 2013. Can the Minister for the Environment say how many fruitings have been culled in the last 6 months in boroughs of the state?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, 4 fruitings have been culled in boroughs of state in the last 6 months.
The reason why I'm raising this particular question is because I've had representations being made to me by tenants of our better state. In fact, I've taken travel myself or taking some pictures of the amount of pigeons. And I would say not just in the Viro Better State, because the whole area that has been affected by all this is cut through the whole of Western water, and there are literally hundreds and hundreds of pigeons just flying around that particular area of the water. And could I ask the Minister on behalf of the tenants of Valbeck Estate whether a particular effort could be made to try
tackle this overpopulation of feathered pigeons in that part of Gibraltar?
The Speaker, I'm glad that the Honourable Member has said that pigeons fly, because I thought that he had forgotten that fact. And the fact that four have been captured in Narrabeen Estate does not mean that those have been caught elsewhere aren't ones that also frequent Narrabeen Estate. They do fly between areas, and therefore you cannot say that the only four of the ones that use Narrabeen Estate have been captured. This is a concern. There is a large number of feral pigeons that there have been for many years, and this is something that my department is addressing with a view to introducing a program which will be able to tackle this.
Can I invite the Minister perhaps to give some details of the particular program in which this will be implemented?
Before I do that, Mr. Speaker, I will refer to my answer last time, which was that there had been 1,347 pigeons culled overall, so it's not that nothing is happening. Increased deployment to a number of areas in order to be able to attempt to bring the population down, and also we are considering whether the feeding of pigeons is something that should be tackled as to whether or not that should be legal. At the moment, it is in the sense that if you put out food, you're putting out litter, but there isn't any specific targeting of the feeding of pigeons, and particularly in certain areas, like, for example, happened in Trafalgar Square, where it was made contrary to regulations, local regulations, to feed them in Trafalgar Square. It may be that we need to look at that, and that is something that is being looked at.
Question 843, the Honourable J.J. Michael.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Environment say what is the carbon footprint cost of importing 143 from Italy for the Commonwealth Park compared to a closer jurisdiction such as Portugal or Spain?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 834.
Question 834.
Could the Minister for the Environment say what is the carbon footprint cost of importing turf from the UK for the Commonwealth Park as compared to a closer jurisdiction, say Portugal or Spain?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the turf for Commonwealth Park were purchased from Italy because Italy is the main producer of quality trees in the Mediterranean. It is absolutely essential for the establishment and success of the park that trees were purchased from the most reputable and reliable source possible. Trees are distributed throughout Europe from Italy, so that, for example, many of the trees that are used for landscaping in the UK arrive from Italy either directly or indirectly via Germany and the Netherlands. In fact, some of the best trees that are sold in Iberia are purchased in Italy and grown on in Iberia, so that purchasing closer to Gibraltar does not necessarily reduce total distance of journey to the trees. The trees from the park arrive from Pistoia, Italy, in five articulated loads. The carbon footprint for the journey will have been about an estimated 29 tons. This is offset by the estimated amount of carbon sequestered by the trees so far, which, given their sizes, is about 103 tons. This offset would also cater for the higher quality turf being imported from the UK, about 28 tons, rather than closer to Italy. The expertise that Italian growers have in packing these trees into lorries, 140 trees in just 5 lorries, means that although the distance covered is of course significantly greater, a larger number of lorries are likely to have been used had the trees been purchased in Portugal or Spain. It's doubtful, furthermore, that trees purchased in Iberia would have approached these Italian trees in quality, size, and health. These factors would, of course, affect future growth and longevity positively, both of which will, of course, enhance future carbon sequestration. When all of these factors are taken into account, it is highly unlikely that there would have been any reduction at all in carbon footprint had these trees been purchased in Iberia. But apart from this, there is of course a net gain in carbon sequestering as a result of the new park, regardless of the tree's provenance, so the park reduces Gibraltar's carbon footprint.
What about financial costs? I mean, before the Honourable Minister or members of the staff went out and ordered these trees, I mean, was there an investigation of prices elsewhere, in Spain, Portugal, closer to home, where it might have been cheaper to purchase these trees? I mean, at the end of the day, I understand that it's always desirable to obtain the best possible quality. But when you're in government, one balances the cost of best quality with obtaining reasonable quality at a lower cost that turns out to be better value for the taxpayer.
Mr. Speaker, I am sure I cannot detect anything behind the words of the Honourable Leader of the Opposition which may suggest that he would rather the trees died, and therefore that we got less quality trees. I say this apart from the intention of perhaps making it a more jovial tone today. It is after all 2 days before Christmas. Because clearly we need to have quality if this thing is going to be a part that will stand the test of time. I do not have a cost for the trees in particular with me. But clearly, they are the best trees available in the Mediterranean, and the long-term cost benefit of acquiring these trees is something that is absolutely clear.
Question 806, the Honourable D.J. Messina.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Employment state whether it is the government's policy not to offer vacancies to those in employment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Speaker, as this House has been told previously, the majority of the vacancies open since 2011 have been filled by persons who are not registered as unemployed. And presumably the answer is that it isn't the government policy, given that on the ground, according to what the Minister is saying, it is not happening.
Mr. Speaker, it follows as night follows day. As if the vacancies have not been open to everybody, it would not have been possible for the vast majority of them to have been filled by people who are not registered and unemployed. Clearly, every time that somebody that is employed already gives up a job in the private sector, especially in the government, the unemployment figures don't go down. But there's nothing I can do about it.
Question 807, the Honourable Mrs. Eleanor Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say when the definition of disabled will change to ensure that all those who suffer disability at whatever stage in their lives will be entitled to disability benefits? What criteria will be used to define disability, and at what stage is government in the review of disability in our laws?
answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, the government is in the process of establishing clear and objective criteria to address the problems faced by those who become disabled but who are not born with a disability. This will be completed within the lifetime of the Parliament.
Question 808, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, combining the right details in respect to the number of employees who may have been employed since the answer provided to question number 650 of 2014 by Leisure Construction and Maintenance Company Limited, broken down by grade, age, gender, and nationality.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Speaker, men have been employed since the answer to question 650 of 2014.
Question 809, the Honourable Jay Mehta.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety provide the November 2013 statistics to Parliament of health and safety as these were unavailable on the government website when the deadline to hand in the petition question to Parliament expired?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over to the Member the information required.
The supplement is rather lengthy, so I suggest that we go on to the next question and the Honourable Member can come back and ask supplementary when he has started the information. Okay? It won't be necessary, Speaker, because subsequent to the closing of the day, it's in the website, so I've got it here with me, so I can ask the supplementary question right straight away.
Mr. Speaker, could I ask the Minister for Health and Safety, because I've been looking at one of the tables in particular, I'm referring to the table for monitoring activities, and I'm very in front of them. And I can see that, I mean, monitoring activities for the month of November, you're talking about, and I can see that there was a total of 44 activities, which are later broken down by each particular component. But of the total of the 44, 34 correspond to the construction industry. Now, the construction industry is just one industry group of 21 within the labor market. That represents 77% of the total amount of monitoring activities for the month in November of the total. Could the Minister perhaps give an explanation why this usually a high figure of 77% dedicated just in the construction industry?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I can give him the same explanation that I gave him the last time he asked an identical question, which is that construction activities take place in sites that stop being workplaces when the work is completed and open up new sites. Whereas if you look at the rest, it's all inspections of permanent places, of shops, retail trade, road transport. In all those cases, the place that is inspected and if the inspectors don't find anything wrong, they don't have to keep on coming back. But in the construction sector, you can have one construction company and they're opening new sites every month and completing work on other sites. The pattern is the pattern that is normal, has always been there, and it is explained by the fact that construction companies are mobile from side to side, but top to not. They're always in the same place.
This is a big idea, but part of the answer given by the Minister in the sense that construction sites are mobile, and therefore the health and safety inspector will want to inspect every perhaps new particular site that emerges in a particular construction. But the fact is that the figures are simply disproportionate. I mean, when you look at it when you look at it in the month, you have a total of 77% of the time dedicated to monitoring to that particular industry group. I mean, there are, and I've done an exercise myself, and I don't want to go into a lengthy explanation here because it's question time, particular industry group in the whole of this year, which has not had one single inspection at all within the labour market. It just shows that there is a disproportionate amount of time dedicated only and exclusively, well, I wouldn't say exclusively, but mainly on the construction industry to the neglect, perhaps, of other industry groups. And can I ask, because it's a question then, can I ask the Minister whether he can discuss this with his own officials in order to see that other industry groups have some attention as well, because at the moment they're not having any attention at all?
No, Mr. Speaker, I will not do that, because I don't think it is my job to tell the health and safety inspectors how best to conduct the activities that are required to conduct under the law. I don't think that I am qualified to tell them that the amount of time that they spend going to construction site is disproportionate. I don't know if that was the practice before 2011. I find out if it was, but depending on the practice now, I don't intend to introduce it.
Mr. Speaker, and I see the Honourable the Minister for Financial Services laughing. It's not a laughing matter. The reality is that the Honourable Mr. Neto has pointed out that there are industry groups that have not received any visits from inspectors at all. He may not give instructions to inspectors as to who to visit or who not to visit, but ultimately he's politically responsible if inspections are not being conducted with the efficiency that they ought to be conducted, and that there are industry groups that are being effectively neglected or not being inspected. Now, doesn't that believe that is a matter of concern, and at least we must undertake to go back and to actually look at the group in terms of industry groups of inspection, and if there is a particular problem by way of neglect of a particular sector, that perhaps he ought to have a word with his inspectors and at least ask why it is that these industry groups are being neglected or there are no inspections in relation to them.
No, Mr. Speaker, I will not be any of that, because I don't think that just because the Honourable Member opposite gets it into his head that there is a huge neglect of people who are at serious risk or no risk or any risk at all, when there is overwhelming evidence that the vast majority of accidents at work happen in areas like the construction industry where people are at risk. And it's quite obvious that the level of risk that takes place in simply because anybody that has been at work knows that in an office, the lawyer is not the same as if you are going up a staff within the building site. So clearly, the inspectors who know their job and are professionals are doing the work in the way they think is more efficient. Let me say that this new interest in health and safety is surprising when, in fact, I made public recently the fact that there is a requirement in the 1996 regulation that every single entity in Gibraltar should produce a risk assessment and keep a record of places where there are more than five, and the department had no evidence that that had been complied with, and in fact are now in the process of ensuring that in areas where it has not been complied after somebody approaches the department, the employer to find out if it is there and if it's a record, it will be done, and are given a public commitment that every single employer will have a risk assessment required of them, as the law states, within a year. I don't think that is more than can be done to do what is the basic thing, which is to do a risk assessment. When that has not been done, surely the risk assessment is going to be done over the next 10 months will show us whether there are other areas that potentially we should be devoting more attention to.
Question 810, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
The figure 30 months of into question number 704, 2013. Can the Minister for Health and Safety say for what reason or reasons did the fact inspector seek legal advice in the month of October?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, the legal advice pursued by the inspector was on how to proceed after an improvement notice issued to DFI was appealed.
Was this improvement notice issued in September?
Elizabeth.
And was the reason for the legal advice because the employer in this particular case was not putting right basically what the fact inspector had placed in the present order?
Well, as the original answer states, Mr. Speaker, if the employer in question gave notice of appeal, it followed logically that he didn't agree with the assessment of the inspector, and that's why he was going to appeal. In actual fact, when the matter was referred to the Attorney General for advice, the inspector went back to DFI and they agreed to comply with the inspector and it didn't go any further. But if he had gone to appeal, the inspector needed the assistance of the legal department on how to deal with the appeal.
I'm not sure whether I understood the minister correctly. Is he therefore saying that while that in seeking legal advice, the actual work has not progressed on site or they have progressed on site? I wasn't clear there.
What is the goal to do something in his workplace to change something and he decides to appeal, then it means that he doesn't accept that what he being asked to do has to be done. I am telling him that that is why the inspector, the appeals are very, very well. The inspector then went to the agency chamber to say, well, look, this guy's a resistant of what needs to be done, and they're going to go to appeal for how they will deal with it. I'm also telling him, although he hasn't asked me, that in practice, after that step was taken and they went back, the company concerned changed his mind, decided not to proceed with the appeal and complied with the order.
Question 835, the Honourable D. A. Eaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please explain why the government laid the artificial reef in the area that it did at the time that it did?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, I'm answering on the creation of the artificial reef as this was an environmental measure coordinated and managed by my ministry. The location of the artificial reef is paramount as this will largely determine the success of the prospect of the project. I apologize, Mr. Speaker. As this will likely determine the success of the project so that it will enhance the area's marine environment. More specifically, the Northwest Artificial Reef was laid in this area for the following reasons. 1. Seagrasses were prevalent in the area as documented by experts in scientific journals, but these have been destroyed by fishing activities, particularly raking. The design and layout of the reef has been done to facilitate the planting of seagrasses. 2. The seabed is of a sandy composition. The Department of the Environment has been continuously monitoring the water sediments and biological conditions of the site, which proved to be suitable for the creation of an artificial reef. 3. The area is not a shipping lane or four military exclusion zones, and four, it is an area within British Gibraltar territorial waters which provides no negative environmental impact but maximum environmental gain. So these being in sacred waters is the ideal location to provide a spawning area for fish and marine life, provide an area for the decolonization and or relocation of seagrasses, provide natural protection for the decolonization of habitat directives and export species as listed under the habitat directive, for example, pinna nobilis, improve surface populations, provide a habitat for benthic communities to develop, and provide a new space for diving and snorkeling activities. In terms of timing, calm conditions with minimal wave, wind, and tidal influences favor the deployment of artificial reef modules. The Northwest Artificial Reef was deployed during the summer on the 24th and 25th July 2013, since the forecast meteorological and sea state conditions were deemed suitable for said deployment.
Was there any discussion at all, or was it factored into the decision to lay the reef in August? And I recognise that the government has every right to lay this reef where it laid it, in July. But was there any discussion, or was it factored into the decision, the possible repercussions that might have flowed from the laying of the reef, and the impact that that would have had in terms of local traders, because of, indeed there has been an impact on local traders, the consequence of the problems that we've had in the frontier. And was that factored into the decision-making process by the government or the minister or the chief minister when the decision was taken to lay this particular reef in July?
I'm not going to be engaging the leader of the opposition on what the Chief Minister and the Minister for the Environment have discussed.
Yes, but Mr. Speaker, that is wholly inadequate answer in respect. We have a week that has been laid in July. It is provoked, unjustifiably so. We recognise that, unjustifiably so, but in our view, predictably so, a reaction from Spain, which has involved restrictions on the border, which has then caused huge problems, particularly for Main Street traders, at the height of the clear season in August and September, which has led many of these traders to see a downturn in their turnover for those 2 months. I would have thought, and does not agree with me, that any prudent and reasonable government would have factored into their decision-making process that kind of consequence, despite having the legal right and the moral right, whatever you like, in terms of laying that loop, but factoring it into the decision-making process, those consequences for many street traders and other businesses in Gibraltar.
Before the Chief Minister answers that supplementary question, let me make it clear that I am not going to allow a debate this morning arising from this question about the sovereignty of restrictions or the measures being adopted by the Spanish government and for whatever reason it may be. If the honourable members of the opposition wish to, they can raise the matter later on the agenda. It is a proper matter to raise on the agenda when a 40-minute debate can take place without a vote being taken and without a formal motion, or they can raise, they are free, under the rules of this House, they are free to bring a motion on the question of the frontier restrictions whenever they so wish, and then different rules will apply because it will be a debate. But this morning, our answers on this question, we are not going to have such a debate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for that, because I think that's exactly what the other leader of the minister wants. May I just comment in respect of what you said? That, of course, a motion on the adjournment holds in respect of matters which are urgent, and something which has been going on apparently since August, is not going to, in my view, attract the epithet of
Prime Minister. Not just urgent, but on any other matter, and if any other matter that could have arisen during question time, and then it is for the Speaker to decide whether that is an appropriate matter to have a debate on the adjournment.
I'm going for Mr. Speaker, but let me be clear that the motion on the adjournment is not the sort of procedure that should be used by opposition to the fearful of losing votes on motions. The opposition, if they want to debate this issue with the government, are free, of course, to do so, and the government very much welcome the opportunity of debating this with the opposition. But let's do it on a motion, Mr. Speaker, that's clear, and let's do it on a motion where we take a vote. Mr. Speaker, the position is very clear. I'm not going to engage the leader of the opposition on what it is that the government considers when it makes a decision. If I start the process of answering in respect of that question, then we're going to be here simply analysing who said what to who in Cabinet before a particular decision that honourable members like or dislike was taken. But I do have to take issue with much of what the honourable leader of the opposition has said. He appears to not be living in the Gibraltar that most of the rest of us are living in. He appears not to have lived the history of Gibraltar that the rest of Gibraltarians have lived it. And I say that, Mr. Speaker, not in respect of the restrictions of 1969 to 1982 and then 85 in the front of final years, but of course, Mr. Speaker, in respect of the period of restrictions and of frontier queues and of rhetoric that the honourable member didn't live with us because he was happily ensconced up in the north of England being a barrister there. And he might not recall, and I hope that this is of assistance to him, Mr. Speaker, that at the time that the GSD were in administration, when they laid no reef, Mr. Speaker, and they tore up no fishing agreements, in fact, they did them, we had, apparently I am for sound, Mr. Speaker, I hear the Honourable Lady opposite saying, because I am reminding him of this, we had extremely long frontier queues, we had extremely negative rhetoric, all from the same place that we have them today, the Palacio de Santa Cruz and the Partido Popular foreign ministers of the time. And there is a very informative article today, Mr. Speaker, that I recommend to members opposite, Mr. Speaker, in a publication in Spanish called Público, Público.es, which analyzes what is Plan A and what is Plan B for the Spanish foreign ministry. Plan A, Mr. Speaker, is being nice to the Gibraltarians and see if they will agree to transfer the sovereignty of Gibraltar. Plan B says, Mr. Speaker, if having been nice to the Gibraltarians, they do not agree to any progress on issues of sovereignty, then start getting tough. And if the Honourable Gentleman says, well, Mr. Speaker, didn't you consider Plan B when you were considering with the Honourable Minister for the Environment whether such a reef could be created in British Gibraltar territorial water or not? Let me put it to him, Mr. Speaker, that he should go back and do a bit of research. Not so much on the numbers of inspections that health and safety officers rightly do in respect of construction, in the construction industry, rather than analysing health and safety in hairdressing salons and spas. But to read the words of Senor Mariano when he was first appointed Minister for Foreign Affairs of Spain, not when he said, he's like that Espanol, or esta problema se ha acabado, this joke is over. But when he said in a lengthy interview on the 21st of January 2012, to the speaker for the purposes of assisting him, that's 19 months before the reef was laid. 19 months before the reef was laid. We are not going to progress with the trilateral process. That is at an end. And from now on, we will have regional cooperation so long as there are advances on sovereignty. Not otherwise.
Can I bring the Chief Minister back? Can I bring the Chief Minister back to the question and answer? The question was, as to the reasons why the government laid the artificial reef in that area, and the time that it did so. The Honourable Minister for Health and Environment has given detailed answers based on environmental and biological conditions as to why that was proceeded with. And I am only going to allow any further supplementaries to deal with those aspects of the question and the answer. Anything else to do with the wider political issue, honourable members can debate whenever they so wish. I make myself available for that purpose, and I will then apply the liberal rules of debating which follow. But we are not going to do that this morning, and I am bringing this matter to a conclusion unless the supplementary questions are within the parameters that I have decided.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very happy to accept your ruling. I will allow the Minister for the Environment to deal with the biological or environmental aspects of this matter. He's much better qualified than I am, and I think I've dealt with the political aspects that were raised by the leading individual.
Mr. Speaker, I'm interested in the political questions and in the political answers. If I can't ask political questions and receive political answers, then I'm not going to pursue the matter further.
Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman that environmental issues and biological issues are highly important political issues too?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, but I am interested in the reasons why the government took a decision which in my view has turned out to be one of the most monumental areas of government in the political history of the world.
May I make it clear that, as Speaker, I am also interested in those decisions. I don't want anybody to go away with this house under the impression that I am curtailing discussion on these matters. I'm just saying the question time is not the appropriate time to do so. And I invite honourable members of the opposition, if they so wish, to table a motion at the earliest convenience in order to debate this important issue. I don't want anyone, members of the public in particular, who may not understand what the rules of procedure are, to think that the Speaker is curtailing debate. The Speaker is not curtailing debate, provided it is at the time when debate is called for. We are dealing with questions and answers, the purpose of which is to ask for information, to enjoin the government to adopt a particular course of action, or to adopt a certain line of policy. That is what question time is about.
I'm very grateful, Mr. Speaker. I think it's important the public should know that we are prepared to debate these issues. Mr. Speaker, I think it is entirely politically appropriate that I do deal with the Honourable Gentleman's last point, because I think the public will realise, Mr. Speaker, that the biggest monumental error of judgment made in the modern history of Gibraltar was actually to leave the GSOP as it was in the ascendant, going to join the GSP. And in any event, Mr. Speaker, in any event, history will judge this government for everything it has done, not just but including the youth, much more fairly than the opposition would like us to be judged for their own narrow political purposes. And when we do, Mr. Speaker, the advances made in respect of that those waters of the isthmus may not look like such a monumental error of judgment.
And I will enjoy bringing a final question to your government in 2 years' time.
Is there any supplementary on this particular question? If not, we will proceed to the next one. Now, I see that the matter has been satisfactorily dealt with, therefore.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has made the point that I think it is right that I should be able to answer, because if only with this observation, Mr. Speaker, I think what you have done this morning, Mr. Speaker, is to rightly draw out the lead of the opposition, so that we have now been able to see, and so has all this community, that all of these issues that you want to debate, he's not interested, Mr. Speaker, in any details as to the biological or environmental reasons for the creation of the roof. He just wants to use this opportunity, Mr. Speaker, to hurt the government politically so that he can bring a final question on our government in 2 years' time. Mr. Speaker, for the purposes of the record, let me just remind him that the person who will decide when to bring the final curtain down on the lifetime of the Parliament will be me. When I go and see the Governor to ask him to convene a general election. But we don't know yet, Mr. Speaker, who will lead the parties into that general election, what the parties will be, which party he will be in at the time, Mr. Speaker. And the general public will decide who it is that governs the vote afterwards. He shouldn't assume that he is going to win any elections in the future.
And I'm bringing now a final question on this question, and we go on to the next one. Question 836, the Honourable J.J. Neto.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister state the breakdown of expenditure so far since the commencement of this financial year in relation to 1, protocol, 2, travel, and 3, entertainment,
by all members of the government, broken down by each separate category and stating the purpose, place, and date in which such events took place.
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 837 and 838.
Question 837, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please provide a breakdown of all costs of the taxpayer of a recent visit to the Fourth Committee of the United Nations, identifying everyone who was paid for by the taxpayer, together with items of expenditure associated with that individual?
Question 838, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Can the Chief Minister please provide details of the cost of the Mega Pop Concert, the Jazz Festival, the Literary Festival, and the Gibraltar Day in London?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, ministerial travel costs are put on the government's website as invoices are received and paid, including those of the Deputy Chief Minister, Minister Liguri, and my own, in respect of our travel to the United Nations this year. Should any further ministerial costs be received, they will be reflected on the website. Details of protocol and entertainment have never been provided before the financial year end by any administration, as that amounts to, in effect, providing a management account of ongoing expenditure. With respect to questions 837 and 838, however, I now hand over a schedule with the information requested, accepting the special protocol.
My attention has been drawn to the fact that the Chief Minister has been missed out the last line of the question.
Very grateful. In relation to question 8783, there's another sentence I should have read out. The 19th Government delegation on this occasion, the occasion of our visit to the United Nations, also included the Director of Education and six students.
I have the schedule here in front of me. It doesn't include, and can I take it from the non-inclusion, that it doesn't include anybody from the self-determination group, it doesn't include Mr. Matthews, unless I made a mistake. Does that mean that Mr. Matthews paid for his own travel and expenses to the United Nations, and that is why it doesn't appear in this particular schedule?
Well, if you're asking for matters, that, Mr. Speaker, the only thing I can say is that the government didn't pay for it.
I thought you're reading to doubt. I can confirm that it wasn't paid through any government or company, either directly or indirectly.
Mr. Speaker, as far as I know, we have not paid for the SDG to come with us to the United Nations. Through the government, the savings bank, credit finance company, all the ones that they say are secret, Mr. Speaker, but they know everything about us and so does everyone else in our community.
Question 839, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please state whether the investigation into the new professional tax affairs of the former Speaker of this House is now concluded?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this investigation has now concluded, and no evidence as to the source of the leak has been established by the Chief Secretary. A report of the investigation is presently being prepared.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in relation to the report that he says is being prepared, is that a report that is a report to government that will not be made public, or does he intend to make it public? Will he lay it before this House? I mean, what is his intentions in terms of the report into this particular issue, which is a serious issue, not only generally, but also for members of this House. I mean, at the end of the day, this is the Speaker of the House, and his personal tax affairs is linked to members of the
House. But I think the Honourable Gentleman understates the seriousness of what happened here. That to have the tax affairs of any individual being linked to the press is, to say the least, criminal. To have them leaked of a member of this House is criminal and raises political issues too. And therefore, I will not commit myself to publish the report for exactly the reason that I said to him in answer to question 497 of this year, which I'm sure he will recall, namely that it may be that that report leads to my making, or my or whatever the appropriate mechanism is, to a criminal report being made for further criminal investigation.
Well, I understand that if the report focuses on evidence that may form the basis of a criminal investigation, that it may not be appropriate to disclose the report. I understand that. But as I understood the answer, really the government or the two secretaries have not been able to get to the bottom of how or where and when the ins and outs of the leaking of this particular information. Now, if there is nothing there in this report that can form the basis of a criminal prosecution, because at the end of the day it really is inconclusive, and is there any reason why the government will not disclose the report so that at least members of the opposition can look at it and also can look at the thoroughness of the investigation and the way the investigation is being conducted? We're perfectly entitled to do so, you know.
Whatever he can do what he likes. He can look at whatever he likes. But what he's not going to become is the policeman of the two secretaries. When he's saying, Mr. Speaker, that he has some doubt as to the thoroughness of the investigation undertaken by the two secretaries, I must say, Mr. Speaker, that I watch in awe, watch, because now we are able to offer the reforms that this government has made. The allegations being made in respect to employment issues when the Honourable, the Minister for Health was answering questions, and all of those implications that you were good enough to point out about the Public Services Commission and its working. Are we now to have suggestions in this House that in respect of something as important and as sensitive and as frankly unacceptable as a leak of a taxpayer's information, the Honourable Gentleman thinks that it is up to him to determine whether or not the government or the chief secretary have been thorough in investigation? Well, look, Mr. Speaker, that is never going to be a reason for us to publish a report. What I'm saying to him, in trying to agree, in fact, in going further than his own view to the seriousness of this leak, Mr. Speaker, is that the report may take matters further. It may take them outside the ambit of simply a civil service investigation into what has happened. But certainly, Mr. Speaker, if the report is published, it will not be in order to enable the Honourable Gentleman to make himself the policeman of the policeman.
Because he really is very long-winded in his answers today, and he really is waffling and waffling and waffling, more so today than another occasion. But it's not up to me. It's not up to me. But I am perfectly entitled to examine that report and make my own mind up as to the quality of investigation. That's part of the role of the opposition. Or is it really suggesting that the opposition is not entitled to look at this report and make up its own mind as to the thoroughness of an investigation into a very serious issue? Of course, there are criminal implications, but it's also a matter of extreme importance to members of this House that in relation to a member of this House that there has been the leak of personal tax affairs that ultimately led to the Speaker's resignation last year. Now, Mr. Speaker, does he not recognise that the opposition is entitled to that information?
Mr. Speaker, the previous Speaker of this House, who gave 8 years of service to the community and to the Parliament, explained why he resigned. In fact, not why he resigned, why he retired. He never suggested it was anything to do with the malicious leaking of information dealing with his tax affairs.
The Honourable Member of the Division has just said the opposite. So, Mr. Speaker, there's only been one speaker who has resigned as a result of something related to the work he's done in this House. And that was Mr. Alcantara, who had to face a motion of no confidence in the Speaker that the government voted against him because he'd ruled in a way that the government didn't like. The government which he supported, the government he then became a member of, when he made the monumental error of judgment of leaving the GSOP in its ascendancy and going to the GSOP in its ascendancy. But Mr. Speaker, how can you say that he's entitled to a report, to a government report? Well, Mr. Speaker, if he has any legitimate expectation that he might see the report, which he does not, it might be because we published the report. And Mr. Speaker, is it that I had an entitlement, to use a word, to see the customs report prepared by the British administration, which they refused to publish, or to see the IM2 report into the future GDC, which they have prepared at a huge cost to the taxpayer and refused to publish? Well, Mr. Speaker, where was the entitlement then when we used to sit here and sneer as the government minister when those reports were not published? This report is going into a very sensitive matter, and I'm telling the House it may lead to more. And all I am saying is I cannot commit myself to publish the report as a result of that. But Mr. Speaker, we're watching, Mr. Speaker, I think anybody who's been watching today will know that they're the ones gobbling like turkeys waiting for Christmas, and we're the ones talking turkeys.
He really has a propensity, I mean, he does it better than anybody else. The grandstand, the showmanship, the Hollywood, that's his thing. I have to say that that's his thing, and I congratulate him for it. But Mr. Speaker, does he not recognize that he got elected on a ticket of doing things differently, even if it were right what he said? He was elected on doing things differently. And who can say the many occasions that we have not published the King Report? Do we not recognize, therefore, that not to take a leap out of his own political discourse and do things the way that he used to think that he was going to do things before he became Chief Minister of Gibraltar?
And Mr. Speaker, look, I think the Honourable Gentleman has not wanted to hear what I say. And he accuses me of grandstanding, but he is asking questions despite my answer being the report may be published unless there are reasons why it should not, because it may lead to a prosecution. Now, Mr. Speaker, of course we are doing things differently. There was a new dawn, thank goodness, on the 9th of December 2011. Things have changed. This Parliament is unrecognizable. People can watch us at home. And so much more has happened, Mr. Speaker. But everybody knows that there has been real change in our community. But what I cannot do, Mr. Speaker, is when we are dealing with a report that may lead to a prosecution or an investigation, or may be tangentially related to a prosecution or an investigation, commit myself today, and that is what we're arguing about, to publish the report. Now, Mr. Speaker, maybe that those things don't come to pass, and the report can be published, because my inclination, as honourable members know, and they take me at my best in this respect, is always to publish unless there's a good reason not to. But that doesn't mean, Mr. Speaker, because there has been a new dawn, because at last there is transparency, because we are more open government, that the honourable members can have a webcam set up in each of our offices to hear what we talk about when we're going to decide whether or not to lay a wreath, to look at what it is that we're doing in the special report, and to have access to any information that may be of an important prosecutorial nature. But Mr. Speaker, let us not stop him from sitting down or making him a fool to say, bah, humbug to everything.
And Mr. Speaker, nobody is asking for disclosure of this report if at the end of the day it's going to lead to a criminal prosecution or a criminal investigation. I'm not suggesting that. On the contrary, I said, if it doesn't do that, there is no reason why you ought not to disclose it, and certainly not disclose it to the opposition. Now, my final supplementary, really at least, if it doesn't, if there is no criminal investigation, or criminal prosecution, criminal investigation really, does he undertake to at the very least allow me to cite as leader of the opposition of this report, bearing in mind that it does go to the privileges to disclosure of personal tax information of a member of this House, and it relates to this House, and as leader of the opposition, will you at least undertake
can let me see a copy of that report, even if on a confidential basis.
Mr. Speaker, I said at the beginning of my answer to supplementary, but my answer remained in the sector of question 497, which it was in June of this year. The other member of the supplementary is identical to the one he asked me in supplementary then, so I will just remit myself to saying this, because at line 270 of the excellent answer that has now produced so much more quickly for these monthly meetings that we now have, instead of the one or two that they used to have when they were in government and called themselves democratic. And I said this, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I cannot commit myself to that, the undertaking that he asked for, for a reason that I hope you will understand. It could be that this leads to criminal proceedings and therefore that the matter might be overtaken by the issue becoming the subject of a complaint or a charge. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, I do not think it is appropriate for me to give the House an undertaking that this will result in a stay of my being the House or the tabling of an investigation report, because it could become much more serious than that, and I hope he understands that reasoning. Mr. Speaker, I have said throughout the course of questions and answers this morning, the very same thing. If it leads to an investigation or at a criminal level, I cannot publish it. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, the opposite must also be true. If it doesn't lead to an investigation for criminal proceedings, then I will be free to publish it.
Mr. Speaker, does that mean, because he hasn't given me an answer straight after this question, does it mean that if it doesn't lead to a criminal investigation, that the Honourable the Chief Minister will make that report public, one, and two, but at the very least, he will allow me to see it even on a confidential basis. Not asking about criminal investigations. This is never for me being about a report that leads to a criminal investigation. If it leads to a criminal investigation, I understand. If it doesn't, that's the question.
I've already answered those questions.
Question 840, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, did the Chief Minister read the speech of the self-determination group, the voter group chairman, Dennis Matthews, before it was delivered to the United Nations?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Yes, sir. Mr. Speaker, did you agree with the sentiments expressed by Mr. Matthews at the United Nations comparing the actions of Spain to Gibraltar to that of Kerry?
Later. Question 841, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
And Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister state where the government has abandoned its plans to set up an anti-corruption authority?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we have not abandoned our plans in this respect and expect to make an announcement in due course.
Mr. Speaker, is this something that the government intends to do during the course of 2014, just to sort of put a tighter timetable on the answer that the Honourable Gentleman has given?
Mr. Speaker, the government does not accept tighter timetables from the opposition. Our manifesto is to be performed in the lifetime of the Parliament. Some things may be now performed in 2014, some in 2015, and in fact, Mr. Speaker, as you understand, there is a procedure we may be able even to go into 2016.
Yes, indeed. Will this involve the introduction of legislation in order to create this particular authority? And how does the Honourable the Chief Minister envision that this will plug in to existing legislation, or will it require wholesale legislation hermetically sealed from existing legislation, in particular, for example, the Crimes Act and the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act?
I don't know if that's an analogy that you can use, but I think legislation, Mr. Speaker, it's very likely that this will require new legislation. I'm not going to debate with him at this stage how it's going to be done. He will see when an announcement is made how we expect it to interface with existing legislation.
Question 842, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please say what is the total amount paid by Credit Finance Company Limited in commuted pensions of civil servants?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer together with question 843.
Question 843.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please say how many civil servants have had the commuted pensions paid A, by Credit Finance Company Limited, and B, from the controller of the funds whose Credit Finance Company Limited was incorporated?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as of the 31st of October 2013, the total amount paid by Credit Finance Company Limited in commuted pensions to civil servants is $18,123,986.28. Figures at the 30th of November have not yet been finalized by the Treasury. Therefore, answers reflect tentative figures as of the 31st of October 2013. 124 civil servants have had their commuted pensions paid by Credit Finance Company Limited. 61 civil servants have had their commuted pensions paid from the Consolidated Fund, once the incorporation of Credit Finance Company Limited, as follows. 9 gratuity payments on retirement, 39 revised gratuity payments for civil servants who retired and have their gratuities paid prior to the incorporation of the company, and 7 gratuity payments on death, and 6 gratuity payments on resignation.
Just by way of clarification, did you say 18,018, or did you say 18,000,000? It's just we didn't tell quite clearly.
18,123,986.28.
Question 844, the Honourable D.J. Rufino.
When originally drafted, it was got up the other minute of the season, as being a Chief Minister who was going to be entered. So I stayed with him in those terms. Can the Chief Minister advise whether any hotels other than the Sunborn, but including the Marriott, are the beneficiaries of any loans from Credit Finance Company Limited or are in any other way receiving financial assistance from the government or the Gibraltar Savings Bank?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm informed that no hotels, other than Sunborn, are beneficiaries of any loan from Credit Finance Company Limited, or in any other way receiving financial assistance from the government or the Gibraltar Savings Bank. Mr. Speaker, you know that that question is answered in the spirit of what he has asked, and not in respect of, for example, whether they have a rate of water or electricity. I don't know what that updated position is, but it dawned on me when answering that if they were being particularly pedantic, they might suggest, well, if a hotel hasn't paid 2 months of water or electricity, is that financial assistance from the government? He knows what I'm answering, I think, the question he's asking me by giving this answer. It's in relation to loans, as I understand it.
Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the question is in relation to whether any actual payments have been made in the country. So he's going to give a proposal to the other question. Yeah. A point of clarification to my honourable friend, I asked if he's absolutely right. I mean, the marriage is not yet a hotel in Gibraltar. Is there any intention on the part of the government, provide any financial assistance to the owners of the marriage, which is intending to set up shop in Gibraltar?
Because the owners of the marriage have not been in touch with the government in this respect, but the government would be open to considering any similar request from hotel operators in Gibraltar. And I think that there was a scheme in the late 1990s called the Hotel Assistance Scheme, which dealt with similar issues, and the government would be prepared to consider any request for the government to assist in any particular way. Of course, in relation to Credit Finance, it's different. They've got to go through certain procedures as to how they would persuade the people who are responsible for lending in that respect to decide whether there could be a lending. It's a different process. But if the government were to be engaged, the government might be very willing to consider some incentive for any of the new proposed hotel development.
And can you confirm there's been no request from the owners of the Marriott for any kind of financial assistance similar to the one provided to the owners of the Sunborn by Credit Finance?
Mr. Speaker, I don't know what the updated position is in that respect. As far as I know, the owners of the Marriott have not been in touch with the government at all, with the government. Have the developers been in touch with the government about similar issues? I think there may have been a request. I think I don't know where that lies. I don't know what amounts we're talking about, and I don't know whether it will progress or not. I know they have other sources of funding. I assume he's asking me because he knows that he represents some of them.
Earlier on, the Honourable Speaker said that the opposition to make itself responsible for the accuracy of the questions. I think the Honourable Chief Minister ought to make himself responsible for the accuracy of anything that he knows. I represent nobody in relation to this particular
complex project. I mean, he knows that I'm a litigant, I'm not a commercial lawyer, and therefore he couldn't possibly make a statement that I represent these individuals because there is no evidence to suggest that is what I say.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I tell you why he's completely wrong. His firm represents a number of them, and as a president of backbencher, Chief Minister used to say, if your firm is involved, then I impute knowledge to you. And of course, Mr. Speaker, he's right under the solicitor's rules. If your firm is handling something, then you, as a partner of that firm, which I'm delighted to describe himself as a senior partner of a stand, you must be imputed with that knowledge.
I don't know where he gets that I describe myself as a senior partner or whatever. I'm not going to go into this. But Mr. Speaker, I have absolutely no knowledge of this or anything else relating to this particular project. And look, you know, the honourable Chief Minister, every single time I ask a question, either about this or about something else, he seems to hide behind or attempt to make political points at my expense that I'm a partner of Hassan. Well, he used to be a partner of Hassan. I don't know whether he continues to be a partner of Hassan, but I don't think that it's legitimate for the Honourable Chief Minister to make assertions as if I am the guy that's representing these people and I have knowledge in relation to this particular project. I don't think it's a fair point for him to make.
The Honourable Gentleman has never made a point politically in his life that I have had to hide away from, let alone any that he's made in this house. But, Mr. Speaker, I will take his point. I think he's entirely wrong, and I will simply rely on the statements made by his erstwhile leader, Sir Peter Kagwana, who is not here now, when I was in his position and I was a partner of a firm and was imputed with all sorts of knowledge of that firm when I was leader of the opposition and a member of the opposition. He can look at the handshake if he likes, and that's when he used to describe himself as a senior partner of a firm, if he likes later, I'll send copies of the press releases.
But if he suggested, because it is an important point, if he suggested that because I am a partner of a firm, that every single time that I ask a question about financial assistance that may have been provided to parties involved in some commercial transaction that I know absolutely nothing about, that simply because I'm a partner of Hassan, that I am not entitled to ask that question and he will refuse to provide me with the answer, simply provide me with the report of, well, you should know because you're a partner of Hassan. Because if that is the position, then I'm afraid that the debt to which this government is plummeting and has plummeted in terms of transparency and accountability is really getting to new depths and new ways in this.
I do fear that the Honourable Gentleman has taken leave of his senses. And he used to sit here when the Honourable, the then Chief Minister, used to make these statements. I have actually provided an answer to the questions, so he must actually, I will take it from his answer, or from his question, be applauding the fact that we are answering these questions when the previous administration would simply say, as Mr. Kamala Sapita used to say to me, you go and ask your partners, you should know you're a partner of Hassan. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful that he acknowledges that that is a debt to which one plummets, and I will take it that he therefore considers that Sapita plummets to death, and that he welcomes the fact that we have answered the question despite the fact that he is a partner of Hassan. How senior, though, is a matter of opinion, depending on who drafts the question. Mr. Speaker, Hassan seems to be getting a lot of free advertising. I'm a partner of the two items of the news. also with the responsibility for tourism. Now, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Chief Minister knows that I asked him about whether the owners of the intended hotel, the Marriott, have received any financial assistance from the government. And the question is that he's paid in terms of the government credit finance or his notes. Now, he then says that it could be that the developers may have sought for financial assistance. Can you expand upon that at all? Can you, is he able to? Because I'd be very interested to learn if he can provide any further information to the site in relation to that. I asked specifically in relation to the owners, but I now ask in relation to, you know, the developers or any other party connected with the Marriott project. Mr. Speaker, I can't give him information at this stage, but I just think there might be something. So if he wants to ask the question next time round with that different presentation, I'll be able to bring any information that is available. And of course, I do recognize the partner of TSM and that we have partners here or ex-partners of Easter as well. It would be unfair not to mention all the law firms in Gibraltar do an excellent job.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'll take him up on that offer, and I will be asking a question at the next sitting, or maybe even like that.
Question 845, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please say whether the government, the Gibraltar Savings Bank, or Credit Finance Company Limited are involved or proposed to be involved directly or indirectly in the business of buying and selling gold or silver bullion?
I'll say the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Question 846, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, bear in mind that we're now 2 years into the new Dawn government. Will the Chief Minister please state whether he's now in a position to identify those foreign investors which he said in an interview with Royal Boom in May of 2011 that he had up his sleeve if his party was elected into office?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker. Yes, sir. The first of these, only the first of these, will be announced shortly, early next year, towards the end of January, where a new economic activity will be made public, which is anticipated to give rise potentially to be a market that could bring major benefits to the water. The announcement involves the creation of an entity which will be a joint venture with a client of the firm, who was previously someone I had the pleasure of representing personally. Others may soon also materialize. Announcements will be made in due course, as and when they crystallize. He did, Mr. Speaker, I hesitate to remind him, undertake to congratulate me when I made the announcement. Well, Mr. Speaker, he hasn't made an announcement. It's an intention. But let me say that any investment that the government brings to Gibraltar, if it's worthwhile, and for the benefit of the community, I'll be the first one to congratulate the government. But I have to say that on this particular occasion, I am rather sceptical that these particular investors are the same ones that he said he had up his sleeve in May of 2011. Perhaps the Chief Minister will forgive me for taking a rather sceptical view that he had nothing up his sleeve in May of 2011. Why has it taken so long, assuming that he did have it up his sleeve in May of 2011? Why has it taken so long for the Chief Minister to now come to this House and to say, well, we might be making an announcement shortly, or we will be making an announcement shortly? Why has it taken so long?
Mr. Speaker, he can be as cynical and skeptical as he likes, but when he sees what it is that happens, he understands that these are exactly the people I was talking about. And it's not that it's taken so long, Mr. Speaker. In January of 2014, will be barely 24 full months since the election of the new Dawn government. That was elected, Mr. Speaker, because, of course, the government before had gone to the end of its term just before Christmas, and therefore there was very little that could be done in the first month. So 24 full months after that, we're already producing not just the inward investment that we've shown already, Mr. Speaker, but new inward investment that is related to these particular individuals. You know, Mr. Speaker, that government works in ways which require things to be checked and tested, etc., etc., and that therefore it's not simply possible. At least these days, in 1988, I'm told by the Honourable Mr. Thomas, things could happen a little bit more quickly because there were no European tendering procedures that had to be gone through, etc. There are new European rules that hinder things. So it has taken some time for these things to actually be mature to the stage of launch. But as he will see, Mr. Speaker, when he realizes who it is that is doing this work and some of the others who are likely to be announced to be doing this work with us in the future, that they are the people I was in touch with at the time I was a partner of the fans, and therefore even his cynicism will, I'm sure, be brushed away.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and even he, I would have thought, would be able to attract some good investment in 4 years of being Chief Minister. I mean, it's already 2 years into his so-called new Dawn government, and over 2 years since May of 2011. But can you give some more information as to, for example, the nationality of these investors or the sectors in which this new investment is going to be relating to? And can we do that so that we get a flavour of what it is that the government is proposing? If we can't, because of some commercial sensitivity,
then I'm not going to test him, but can you provide some further information?
Mr. Speaker, I would have thought even he would be more generous than to describe what he has in the first half of the sentence, at least on the 23rd of December, but never mind.
Mr. Speaker, I will not announce what the thing that will happen in January will be beyond what I've said, because that will be commercially sensitive and we want that to have an impact internationally, and he will see that when it happens, but he can then ask me about it in February, because we hold monthly meetings at the Parliament, is that it? And you have to say in reminding him. But I will tell him about the other area involving other clients of real estate.
Question 847, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker, from the people's estate, what steps the government has taken to stop the smuggling of tobacco from Western and Eastern beaches?
Answer the Honourable Chief
Minister. Mr. Speaker, as I've already been announced publicly, the government is working on a number of measures that have been implemented or are actively being pursued to curtail smuggling from these areas as follows. Firstly, repair works along the front of the fence are ongoing, and a mechanism is in place between Her Majesty's Customs and the Technical Services Department to expedite the repair of any future breaches. This part of the front defence has been in a state of complete disrepair when we were elected. Works are ongoing to finalise the setting up of CCTV installations along the front of perimeter. As of June 2012, government introduced special zones under the Tobacco Act. These included Eastern Beach, the front of fence, and Eastern Beach shoreline upstream, including the Loop area, and Western Beach. Over the last month, these areas have been extended to include the main roundabouts on the frontage, across the runway and up to the Sundial roundabout. Persons within special zones are subject to restrictions in relation to cigarettes and are not allowed to be in possession of 600 cigarettes in a red zone or 2,000 cigarettes in a blue zone. It is also an offence to request or procure any person to export or assist with the exportation of cigarettes by land. Law enforcement officers law enforcement officers may direct persons to leave a special zone if it is believed that they're other interested, Mr. Speaker, in what I'm saying. I'm happy to wait.
Mr. Speaker, I really like me to look at him, but I don't have to look at him to listen to him. I'm now listening.
Mr. Speaker, nothing could really be greater pleasure than him from now on who looks away while I read.
I think that the two honourable members, the Chief Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, let me put it nicely, they are getting a bit carried away this morning. Perhaps it might come down to it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Your advice is always sound. Mr. Speaker, I carry on reading. Law enforcement officers may direct persons to leave a special zone if it is believed that their presence is primarily related to the exportation of cigarettes by land. A specific tobacco operation called Operation Venetian was set up by HM Customs together with the Royal Gibraltar Police and the Gibraltar Defence Police that has been widely reported in the press. The aim is to create a high visibility presence at the hotspot entry exit points in order to deter and disrupt illicit contraband activity. As part of planned infrastructure work in the frontier area, a number of control measures will be introduced. These will deter persons from accessing the frontier fence from the commercial gate up to the eastern coastline. The government has already announced that retail outlets selling tobacco at key residential estates near to the land frontier and beaches will have their tobacco license conditions amended in that they will not only be allowed to sell cigarettes by way of vending machines. In respect of the area of Western Beach, an unclimbable fence has been constructed and handed over to the MAB as part of the ongoing Houston project. The fence, how appropriate, Mr. Speaker, to be called that now that we've both come down to earth. The fence runs parallel 3 metres behind the current frontier fence from Western Beach to the customs pedestrian entrance to the bridge.
Question 848, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Can the Chief Minister please provide the House with an update on the likelihood of ad hoc talks taking place between Gibraltar, the United Kingdom and the Kingdom of Spain?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, all this information in this respect is already in the public domain.
Question 849, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker, does the Chief Minister accept that he can stand firm on issues that are vital and fundamental to the sovereignty, jurisdiction and control of our waters, airspace and land without comparing Spain to North Korea or accusing it of state-sponsored vandalism towards the citizens of Gibraltar at the United Nations?
Answer the Honourable Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I can certainly stand firm against Spain on issues that are vital and fundamental to sovereignty, jurisdiction and control of our waters. The vocabulary I use in doing so is not a matter I am prepared to take advice on from the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition.
But does he regret using the intemperate language that he used and the comparisons that he has, bearing in mind that it really has added a new dimension in my view? You can disagree, of course, but a new dimension in my view in relation to relations between Spain and Gibraltar, which is that it's becoming personalized with the Chief Minister of Gibraltar.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I must say, the Honourable Gentleman's question says that I accuse Spain of state-sponsored vandalism towards citizens in Gibraltar at the United Nations. I don't think I ever used the word state-sponsored vandalism. I don't know why there's a few wants to use that vocabulary. If he wants to pour oil on the flame. Mr. Speaker, I don't recognise the description that the Honourable the Opposition has used of what I said. I don't think I have used intemperate language. The comparisons I have made, I think, were absolutely appropriate when I made them, and I, of course, stand by them. But I do recognise that his position is exactly the same as that of Mr. Van Dunker.
Well, Mr. Speaker, just taking him up on the final part of that answer. I mean, does he not accept that in order to defend the vote of vital interest, one doesn't need to get personal, one doesn't need to use ill-judged statements that will cause offense, not only to a political party. I don't care one foot whether the federal government is offended or is not offended. My concern here is that the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, in defending Gibraltar, as he is entitled to do, and along with itself, I mean, there's no difference between him and I in relation to the defense of Gibraltar's vital interest. But there's no reason. But that what he does is, by using this type of ill-advised, ill-judged language, what he does is he risks not only alienating the federal government, but also alienating political classes in Spain, the media in Spain, and also Spanish citizens. And at the end of the day, what we ought to be doing is standing firm, but also explaining Gibraltar's position in a cool, calm, intelligent way, so that the adverse propaganda that emanates from the federal government is rebutted in an intelligent, calm way, with using reason rather than just simply gratuitous, effectively, insult, which is what it is when one compares Spain to North Korea.
Mr. Speaker, I take it that he didn't write that analogy. But I was interviewed last week, Mr. Speaker, by PR Week in London, who wanted to interview me because of my use of language and how it had changed the way that Gibraltar's message went around the world, and how, in fact, Gibraltar's message went around the world that week in showing up the attitude of the Spanish government. And he might want to reflect on what he said, because I don't think anything that I have said was ill-judged. Neither, Mr. Speaker, has anybody ever come to this House to tell a Chief Minister that their language was ill-judged when he was being critical of Spain. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable, the now backbencher, the Honourable Secretary of Havana, in 1998 and 1999, he'll recall when I, from my speech on the arrival of His Excellency the Governor, where I took the House through some of the things that had happened in the past. The Honourable Secretary of Havana said that something said by Senor Matutis at the time, and you can look at handwriting and see what it is that I was referring to, were mendacious lies. In other words, the Honourable the previous Chief Minister of Gibraltar called the Foreign Minister of Spain a mendacious liar. Right? Apparently, Mr. Speaker, that was calling a spade a spade. Right? I think the Honourable
member looks back at everything I have said, he will not find me actually insulting directly the foreign minister of Spain, whatever it is that I and every other libertarian may think about his policy. He will not have seen me saying that the man has uttered mendacious lies. Now, if you look at what I said, and it's quite remarkable that the Chief Minister is called upon by any opposition to justify his statement in relation to this matter. When I talked about North Korea, what I said was that Spain was exaggerating in its reaction like North Korea exaggerates in its reaction. And you'll recall this because I was asked why I used that terminology. And the exact reasoning was because in August, I think it was August the 4th, Señor Maradona had given an interview to RFA where he detailed all the things that were going to be done by Spain as a result of Gibraltar having inter alia torn up the fishing agreement and created the artificial reef, etc., etc. And what I said at the time, and it was widely reported, I'm surprised he now pretends he didn't read it, was that this is an overreaction a la North Korea, when there's a small commercial difference between them and South Korea about how businesses operate in the demilitarized zone, etc., etc., or with the United States. The reaction from North Korea is, I am going to bring nuclear damnation to the Korean Peninsula, not we need to renegotiate these terms. And that was the analogy I made. I think it's absolutely appropriate analogy, and it's right that as a result of that, Mr. Speaker, the message of the people of Gibraltar went around the world. The things that were happening and are happening in some instances of Gibraltar frontier were found out by people much further than usually find out about what is happening. And editorially, I think you'll find that we had 90-95% editorial support in all newspapers in the world that covered this issue. I'm quite happy, Mr. Speaker, as I said before, that the government archive of newspaper information, etc., should be made public, and I'm going to ensure that it happens and it's put on our website, so the honourable gentleman can see how many people around the world have read about the Gibraltar issue, the problems at the frontier, and how editorial support came down on Gibraltar's behalf without having to spend a huge amount of money on advertising the world over. Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to take advice from him on what vocabulary I should use. I would say this to him, Mr. Speaker. But he likes to go around Spain making speeches that try to ingratiate him to some. Frankly, the balancing act is not falling entirely out of favor with people in Gibraltar. He knows, Mr. Speaker, that one of the things he was saying was that the government of Gibraltar had now not even been able to maintain a relationship with our socialist kindred on the other side of the frontier, was actually not true, that we have actually very strong relationships with the preferred party. And you need to reflect, Mr. Speaker, on the fact that between 1996 and 2003, the Chief Minister of Gibraltar then, the Peter Cavani, the leader of his party, who he has said is, I don't know what he said, is the or among the greatest libertarians of all time, had absolutely no political interlocution with any Spanish political party at a national federal level. In other words, he was accusing the Spanish Prime Minister of mendacious lies, he was having rows with the British government, and from that we moved to a situation where joint sovereignty was almost visited upon our community. Today, Mr. Speaker, this government has an excellent relationship with the Socialist Party in Spain at the level of its National Federal Executive Committee, as well as at the level of its municipalities, although, of course, we don't have to agree on everything. And second, we have a very strong relationship indeed with the British government, which is today made up of Conservatives and Liberals, and with our sister party in the United Kingdom, the Liberal Party. So the position really is that my administration, although we still wish to establish a dialogue with the Spanish government, is not talking to the Partido Popular in Spain, but we are talking to every political party in the United Kingdom and to the principal party of opposition in Spain and to Federico Gannings and other parties in Spain that have wished to establish relations with us. Now, in those circumstances, I think actually, if the honourable member compares the actions of he who he calls the greatest or one of the greatest Gibraltarians of all time between 1996, when Gibraltar was last faced with a Partido Popular government in 2003, with the excellent Newgon government of the Gibraltar Socialist Labour Party and the Liberals,
I mean, he was fine, but perhaps we should not be taking his advice on how we conduct our foreign affairs, certainly not in relation to vocabulary.
I certainly don't accept that one can compare calling a spade, which is you have lied in relation to this position, in your position, in your criticisms or your statements in relation to Gibraltar, to, which is calling a spade, to making a gratuitous, ill-advised comparison of Spain to North Korea, or accusing Spain of state-sponsored vandalism. I just simply do not accept that that is, I think I am going to bring up a point of order, and that is that the honourable members are now debating.
My view with the short point of order, absolutely right, and I of course accept the ruling of that. But the short point of order is, I said to him, I do not recognise that second part of the question. Can you please clarify when I have accused Spain of state-sponsored vandalism?
At the United Nations, when it's a speaker, that is my interpretation of what he said. It's the interpretation of many people, but whether this is proven, I may add, because I've been in Spain over the last 2 weeks delivering speeches, including many people in Spain, many people who actually are favourable and sympathise with the voter's position. Because of the statements that he's made, he's only wanted those people. He's become the problem, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Peter, but I am not the problem any more than Peter Caruana was the problem between 1996 and 2003. The problem, Mr. Speaker, as every Gibraltarian knows, and I know he knows it, Mr. Speaker, but he wants to win an election so desperately that he says anything else to say. The problem is the Partido Popular. Now, Mr. Speaker, in my UN speech, I did not accuse anyone of state-sponsored vandalism. Now, the whole of these sets of questions was premised on the honourable member's view that no doubt the government had paid for the SDG to visit the United Nations. No doubt the Chief Minister had approved the speech of the Chairman of the United Nations, and therefore the Chief Minister of Gibraltar was to be imputed with this statement as to terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism, which is the word that would have fitted in there if that had worked. Mr. Speaker, look, the fact is that I had absolutely no knowledge that was going to be said by Mr. Matthews, in exactly the same way as Mr. Caruana had absolutely no knowledge at the time that he went to the United Nations, that Mr. Zanuck, who sat next to Mr. Caruana, and also didn't have his ticket paid for by Mr. Caruana, was going to say that the Spanish government was trying to annihilate the Gibraltarians, right? I think. And he's trying to commit, and the Deputy Prime Minister, as the brilliant historian that he is, remembers the word, that Spain was trying to commit the genocide of the Gibraltarians. That was not my word. Terrorism was not my word. It was the word of the chairman of the SDG. Genocide was not the word of the people come on. It was the word of Brian Zinnick as the chairman of the UNA. But look, let me be very clear. What is it that I said of the United Nations that incensed people in Spain? It wasn't the North Korean thing. I didn't say the North Korean thing in Spain. In the United Nations. I said in the United Nations, I said in the United Nations that Spain, or one of the law enforcement agencies of Spain, the Guardia Civil, had shot at an innocent Gibraltarian in British Gibraltar territorial waters. That is the issue that people didn't like in Spain about my UN speech, Mr. Speaker. That was absolutely true. I trusted the acceptance of it was true. Led to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, not the Chief Minister of the Baltic, but the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom to raise the issue with the Prime Minister of Spain, to the Minister for Europe to take the issue up with his counterpart, and to know for about and to request for an investigation. But they didn't like it when I said it in front of an international audience. And that's not to accuse them of state-sponsored vandalism, Mr. Speaker. But I will say this, Mr. Speaker, and I just put it on the record so that you know, in case, Mr. Speaker, whoever, heaven forbid, were to become Chief Minister of Gibraltar, or were to be in a position to advise the Chief Minister of Gibraltar. And I certainly hope it's always, if anything, the latter, not the former. I said in my first speech at the United Nations in June 2012 as Chief Minister of Gibraltar to the Spanish government
wake up and smell the coffee, Gibraltar will never be Spanish. I don't know whether he agrees with that or not, Mr. Speaker, but I can tell him that the intense diplomatic activity that occurred after that was huge because Spain just didn't want to hear that expressed in quite those terms. He might not like that either. I love it, Mr. Speaker.
I'm going to allow one further intervention from the legal opposition and from the Chief Minister, and then that is the end of question time.
And Mr. Speaker, yes, he's on a point of order. He's just finished his point of order. I'm not going to respond to his point of order, Mr. Speaker. I have to say that given his track record before he became Chief Minister for lack of judgment, and the lack of judgment that he's exhibited as Chief Minister, if he has become Chief Minister, I would suspect that many other people also have the necessary capability to become Chief Minister. Ultimately, if the people of Gibraltar, want to entrust us with their trust of the next election, it's for them, it's not for me, and it's not for him. But I do think, Mr. Speaker, that Hale is beginning to freeze over slightly, and there is a change of tone from the Chief Minister in terms of the language that he used, which I welcome, and I congratulate the Chief Minister for backtracking on the language that he's used in the past. And can he, just to put it beyond doubt, say that the message has absolute clarity emanated from this Parliament, that the Chief Minister in no way believes that the comparison between Spain and North Korea is a valid one, given him the opportunity, and that in no way does he believe that Spain is in any way responsible for state-sponsored vandalism towards the citizens of Gibraltar.
Mr. Speaker, I really don't know which chamber he is in. He doesn't seem to like to hear the answers that I give. So, as to who will or will not win an election in the future, I am not a crystal ball gazer, and this is not an issue to be dealt with in question time. But yes, you have raised it. But Mr. Speaker, I will just say to him that he had the lack of political understanding to give an interview to GBC during the course of the last by-election at 12 o'clock in the evening, which was going to be aired at 11 o'clock in the evening after polls were closed, where he said, we are going to win this by-election, and this is something that's going to come out after the polls closed. We're going to win this by-election by a very large margin.
You see that in the same way that you can raise point of order about accuracy, I will raise it.
I did not say,
I inform both the Chief Minister and the legal opposition that points of order have to do with the rules of this House and not whether the questions of facts or opinion. Nothing to do with questions of fact or opinion. That is not a point of order.
They are asked that the rules of this House are applied evenly as between your position and the Chief Minister.
I never applied them evenly.
Have I not given the honourable member of the opposition to speak
at the one
you have to this particular
Let me explain.
And I'm not suggesting, Mr. Speaker, that you've done it out of some intention on your part. But of course, you have just taken up a point of order a few minutes ago, basically saying that what I attributed to him was not true. That was a point of order. And he answered in that way, he raised that particular point of order. I am doing likewise. And if the Speaker didn't say to the Chief Minister, that's not a proper point of order. That's why I'm saying that Mr. Speaker should perhaps treat my point of order in the same way that he treated him.
Is he making the point of order?
Are you making the point and that is so called point of order?
I'm having pointed out that those are not points of order, I will not entertain them from any member. It's a simple thing. Now, he has an opportunity, I've been giving him an opportunity, and that is so called point of order, to answer the Chief Minister. Then I will give him an opportunity to make one final supplementary, and then that is the end of question.
So, Mr. Speaker, I know you wanted to say that there was going to be a very large number of people coming out to vote, a huge number of people coming out to vote. But Mr. Speaker, he got it completely wrong, so I think his predictions, actions are very suspect. In fact, I will take it, Mr. Speaker, that when he says that my track record before I became Chief Minister is one to consider also sufficiently, I assume that he means the track record of the most successful leader of the opposition in our Parliament history, who took over, had the pleasure of mine to take over in April 2011 and become Chief Minister barely 9 months later. Mr. Speaker, I would recommend that he follows how I did it, but I'd rather he didn't because I don't want him to win. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member of the Commission also has a problem with his thermometer, because it appears that he thinks that hell is getting warmer and warmer, and that therefore they are colder and colder, and there's a chance that it's going to freeze over sometime tomorrow, Mr. Speaker. He is completely wrong about that, too. I have not detected any change in the way that I deal with issues with Spain. I think I am still as robust and as clear in the way that I deal with the issues. He may not like it because he obviously is recognizing and doing so that I'm doing something right. But Mr. Speaker, he gets up here and he says, look, for you to compare Spain to North Korea was not a good thing and you shouldn't have done it and it was bad for Gibraltar that you did. And then, Mr. Speaker, he gets up and he says, now you have the chance either to say it again or to say that you were wrong. Well, Mr. Speaker, if you were right about the fact that it was a bad thing for Gibraltar to compare Spain to North Korea, which I did not expect, like I said, what is he doing? He's got Gibraltar's interest at heart, inviting me either to do it again or to take a step back. What is he doing, Mr. Speaker? He needs to reflect very carefully on that, because that is what he's doing. And, Mr. Speaker, he does really come across as if he's defending the wrong litigant in this matter. He said he's a litigator, so let's look at it in those terms. He does come across as if he's not defending Gibraltar's best interest here. He seems to have been holding brief for somebody else. Mr. Speaker, it's the difference of approach. Of course, we both have Gibraltar's part. Of course, we both want to defend Gibraltar's vital interest. The difference between the Honourable Member and myself is that I don't need to grandstand, I don't need to be the showman, I don't need to make over-the-top, outrageous statements in order to defend the vote. Now, I've given him an opportunity for him to set the record straight. He hasn't taken him, and he's going to give him one final opportunity. Will he set the record straight? That in the manner that I asked him a few moments ago in relation to the statements that he's made in the public. Mr. Speaker, it's not about a difference of approach, it's about a difference of policy. And he needs to understand it because I do fear that he doesn't realize which party group he sits with, even though he purports to leave it, although we know that we've got two deputy leaders on either side, and there is one with whom I have great affinity, Mr. Bettino, as you know, who I know feels perhaps exactly the same as we do on this side of the House. I don't know about him anymore, Mr. Speaker. This is not about a difference of approach. Mr. Speaker, they are looking at a Chief Minister who will never say that he will even think about recommending an Andorra-style solution to our people. That is not a difference of approach, Mr. Speaker, that is a difference of policy. And it's not a huge difference of policy, Mr. Speaker, but we really come to this nub of the issue. The nub of the issue, Mr. Speaker, is that diplomacy is not duplicity. And it's not one thing, it's not the dumb thing to come and say one thing in Gibraltar in this Parliament and then go to Spain and do another. And the Honourable Gentleman says, I assume trying to be funny, from a 70 position, that diplomacy is not my forte. Well, look, Mr. Speaker, he might think that. I assume he also thinks that of the current incumbent as Foreign Secretary of Spain, because he thinks that the head of science diplomacy is a good diplomat, when he says, he's like, that is what I know, the party's over, and there will be no advances on reasonable or in neighbourly cooperation unless there are advances on sovereignty, then the two and I have different definitions of what is or is not a good diplomat. He has not reflected, however, Mr. Speaker, as I asked him to, on whether, having postulated that comparing Spain to North Korea was a bad thing, he wanted to to invite me to do it again or to withdraw. He hasn't reflected on that, Mr. Speaker. He hasn't reflected on the consequences of it. I think those sitting around him have, because it appears to have dawned on them what he was doing. I will put it this way, Mr. Speaker, and I will quote a politician that all of us can quote a senator for, Mr. Speaker. They can turn as they want to. This government's not for turning.
Answers to written questions. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the answer table, the answer. The written question is numbered W160 to W179 of 2013 inclusive.
Suspension of standing orders, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 73 to suspend Standing Order 71, but also proceed with the laying of import duty regulations on the table.
Once again, carried. Carried to the end, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the Import Duty Franchise Regulations Amendment Number 4, Regulations 2013. The Import Duty Integrated Tariff Amendment Number 7 Regulations 2013.
Order to Government motions. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which is as follows. That this House approve pursuant to Standing Order 59, the suspension of Standing Order 19, but only to the extent that at least 5 days, exclusive of Saturdays, Sundays, and public holidays, notice is required of the motion notified by the Honourable Chief Minister on the 19th of December 2013 and circulated by the clerk on the 19th of December 2013.
I now put the question in terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Chief Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. That this House approved by resolution pursuant to Section 3(2) of the Public Services Ombudsman Act 1998, that the appointment of Maria Hawke as the Ombudsman for Public Services for all the purposes of that Act will effect on Wednesday, the 1st of January 2014, for the term of 1 year. Mr. Speaker, the motion to a very great extent speaks for itself, and I intend to say nothing more. Other than to congratulate Mr. Hook for the excellent work that he has done today and give him the thanks of the community for that work already and to look forward to another year of his work, continued hard work as Ombudsman.
I now propose the question in return for the motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. The Honourable Member wish to contribute?
I'd like to add my own voice on behalf of the opposition, congratulating Mr. Hook. And certainly the opposition will vote in favour of the motion.
I now put a question in return for the motion proposed by the Honourable Chief Minister. Those in favour?
Those against?
Carried. Bills. First and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the Bill for an Act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010 be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a Bill for an Act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Income Tax Amendment Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. And in respect of this bill, honourable members will be aware that I have written to you, certified that this bill is too urgent for the period of 6 weeks to elapse between its publication and the ability of the House to be able to consider it. This is an issue which I know the Leader of the Opposition is aware of, with respect that those are being responsible for the drafting of it whilst I was away from Gibraltar, and we expect that the matter will be dealt with on Thursday. Mr. Speaker, members will be aware that on the 16th of October 2013, the European Commission took a decision to open the formal state aid investigation procedure into two aspects of the Income Tax Act 2010. It published this decision in the official journal of the European Community on the 28th of November 2013, inviting comments from third parties. The two aspects signaled out by the Commission concern the exemption from taxation for A, intercompany loan interest, and B, royalties income. Earlier this year, Mr. Speaker, the EU Code of Conduct Group had found that the exemption for intercompany loan interest was a harmful tax measure under the criteria set out in the Code of Conduct on Business Taxation. The European Commission was also already indicating that this exemption is likely to constitute a state aid. Members will recall that without prejudice to our position that the section in question was not a harmful tax measure, we accordingly abolished this exemption by an amendment we made to the Act this summer and which entered into force on the 1st of July 2013. The bill, Mr. Speaker, does exactly the same thing in relation to royalties. Specifically, it will abolish the exemption from taxation that currently exists for royalties income. The bill follows the same format as that we used for the amendment this summer. It amends Table C of Schedule 1 of the Act, so it includes a new heading on royalties. Table C of Schedule 1 sets out the income which is subject to tax under the Act. I had this amendment put to the European Commission by government team at a meeting in Brussels on Thursday, the 5th of December 2013. Commission case managers reverted to us early last week, stating that the Commission's official team were content with the amendment, although that cannot, for technical reasons, be the formal position of the Commission at this stage. That is remotely to what expected from them at this stage, but that is in itself important. By acting in this manner, amending the bill as we propose, amending the act as we propose in the bill, government is delivering much needed certainty to the industry. It has already effectively addressed the two concerns expressed by the Commission in its decision opening the formal investigation procedure. Of course, Mr. Speaker, we make these amendments without prejudice to our argument that neither exemption constitutes state aid. We maintain that position in the formal investigation procedure as part of our defense.
Before I put the question, is there any honourable member which would speak on the general principles and merits of this bill?
Mr. Speaker, I've been in contact with those who have drafted this particular bill. It's been explained, the policy has been explained, the rationale has been explained, and the opposition will be supporting the bill, and I have nothing further to add than what the Chief Minister has already said.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Income Tax Amendment Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice that the committee statement for reading of the bill be taken today, with all honourable members agreeing.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement for reading of the bill be taken today?
Let us go and third reading the Honourable Achievement.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House will resolve itself in committee to consider the bill caused by clause, namely the Income Tax Amendment Bill 2013. Can I, before we move to the committee stage, I note that absent from my crib is a bill that the Honourable the Minister of Finance has taken.
The bill, a bill for an act to amend the Income Tax Act 2010, clauses 1 and 2.
Clause 1 and 2 stand part of the bill.
The long title?
The long title stand part of the bill.
The Honourable, what do you think?
Speaker, I'd be honored to report that the Income Tax Amendment Bill 2013 has been considered in committee and agreed to without amendments, and I now move they be read a third time in Parliament.
I now pick a question, which is that the Income Tax Amendment Bill 2013 be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Part member's motion, the Honourable A.J. Eaton.
Speaker, I have the opportunity to make a summary of my name as follows. The Society of Youth and Scotland by me are the party members who are known in the Yorkshire Building Society Bill 2013.
I now put the question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Albert Eaton. I now propose.
I'm grateful, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, one moment made the note of Yorkshire Building Society, the North Cathedral Building Society, took effect on the Royal Building in Wales in November of 2011. The Yorkshire Council of Engagement. These two societies continue as the Yorkshire Building Society. However, the Council of Engagement on the Royal Building in Wales did not change the legal position in Gibraltar. This is what results in the anomaly which Gibraltar needs to be rectified. Some members will be aware that in the past, when lending institutions want to undertake this sort of legal entity reconfiguration or restructure, that we facilitate that task by allowing them to do it through a private member bill. That is the nature of the bill and is similar to other tasks in the South in recent years to facilitate the corporate restructuring of lending institutions. Mr. Speaker, work of those societies remains an important part of our sector. We remain committed to the board and the government believes that it is appropriate for this House to assist them in this way by the purpose of the bill. I commend the motion to the House.
I now propose to be questioned in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Albert Eaton. I now put a question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Albert Eaton. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Private Members' Bill, first and second reading. A bill for an act to make provision in connection with the merger of the Norwich and Peterborough Building Society with the Yorkshire Building Society, the Honourable A.J. Eaton.
I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to make provision in connection with the merger of the Norwich and Peterborough Building Society and the Yorkshire Building Society be read a third time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision in connection with the merger of the Norwich and Peterborough Building Society with the Yorkshire Building Society be read a first time. Those in favour?
Those against? Carried.
The Yorkshire Building Society Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the bill now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, as a result of the Council engagement taking effect in November 2011, under the law of England and Wales, more people have emerged with the Yorkshire Building Society and the Merge Society continued as the Yorkshire Building Society. That council engagement did not and could not operate to change the legal position in Gibraltar, and accordingly, although Merge and people no longer existed after the 1st of November 2011, those of its assets and liabilities which before the 1st of November were subject to the law of Gibraltar continued to be so subject after that date. The primary purpose of this bill is to rectify this position with effect from the date of reporting the bill as the appointed day, that is to say, a date to be appointed by myself as the Minister with responsibility for financial services. There is just one section in the bill, Mr. Speaker, which has that respective effect, and that is section 9, to which I will refer specifically later. Neither provisions of the bill have any retrospective effect. Section 1 is formal and common form, Mr. Speaker, in section 2, section 1 defines the two societies, section 2 defines the number of the terms used in the bill. Section 3, Mr. Speaker, is the fundamental provision under which, on the appointed day, every Norwich and Peterborough asset will become an asset of the IBS, the Yorkshire Building Society, and inspected its Gibraltar branch. This provision is similar to that in previous banking transfer bills. Section 4, Mr. Speaker, again is similar to provisions in previous banking transfer bills, and excludes certain assets from the effect of Section 3. Specifically, paragraph A deals with interest in land other than those which are held by way of security and effect on the mortgages. Section 5, Mr. Speaker, deals with a variety of documents which on their face relate to the Norwich and Peterborough
with the section we point today, these are made to relate to the Yorkshire Building Society. This section, section 6, is similar to provision in previous banking transfer bills. Section 6 deals with customer accounts, which up to the appointed day were accounts of the non-competitor. Under subsection 1, these accounts become accounts of the Yorkshire Building Society, subject to the same conditions as applied before the appointed day. Section 7, again, is where comprehensive non-banking transfer bills and deals with disparate matters, all designed to give a smooth transition from non-competitor to the Yorkshire Building Society. Section 8 deals with proceedings that have been begun in error by a Yorkshire Building Society before the appointed day, and which, in the opinion of the court concerned, relate wholly or principally to the establishment or enforcement of a non-competitor asset. Mr. Speaker, Section 9 is the one provision in the bill which has a retrospective effect. This means that it works in favour of people who are mortgagors of non-competitor and as they thought took steps to repay their mortgages. In such a case, the Yorkshire Building Society will support it to release the mortgage, which is originally a mortgage from the non-competitor. The former mortgagor will have relied on this release, although the Yorkshire Building Society did not in law have the power at that time to release the mortgage. If there were no retrospective in these limited cases, the whole matter of the release in consequential dealings, for example by a purchaser from the former mortgagor, would be void and have to be reopened with consequential costs and no doubt distress. It is a condition of the operation of the section that the mortgagor consented in writing to the release. Section 10 is common from firm in banking transfer bills, Mr. Speaker, and in the case of this bill, it provides the Yorkshire Building Society to meet government expenditure in connection with Russian enactment of the bill, the United States and Fair Family itself, as the Minister with responsibility for financial services. I commend the vote of the House.
Before I put the question, does any other member wish to speak in general principles and merit of the bill?
In that case,
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision in connection with the merger of the non-competitor building society with the Yorkshire Building Society be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Yorkshire Building Society Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I expect to the benefit of the committee state before we will be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All the honourable members agree that the committee stays on first reading of the bill be taken today.
Committee stays on third reading. The honourable proceeding.
Mr. Speaker, the honourable move that the House will resolve itself to the committee to consider the following bill called by clause, the Yorkshire Building Society Bill 2013.
A bill for an act to make provision in connection with the merger of the Norwich and Peterborough Building Society with the Yorkshire Building Society. Clauses 1 to 10.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
The Honourable Deputy
Minister. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable report that the Yorkshire Building Society Bill 2013 has been considered and committed and agreed to without amendment, and I now move that it be read a third time and passed.
I now put the question, which is that the Yorkshire Building Society Bill 2013 be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Honourable Deputy Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House is now adjourned to no deal. In doing so, of course, Mr. Speaker, although we are conscious, as in all parliaments, and perhaps sometimes the workings of this parliament descend into almost a festive fuss with people saying on either side, oh, yes, he does, oh, no, he doesn't, to each other. There is, of course, a great deal of personal affection I hold between us all, and I'd like to thank all members of the House for the work they've done this year in their respective roles, and in particular, yourself and your staff for having the patience to put up with all of us. And with every member of this House and our wider community, a very Merry Christmas and a very happy, healthy, and prosperous 2014.
Well, Mr. Speaker, here's a judicial statement that I can associate myself with on behalf of the opposition.
May I wish all honourable members a very joyful Christmas and a happy new year, and also extend those wishes to members of the staff and indeed to the Royal Devoted Police that are always in attendance when we are in session, and of course the members of the press. I now propose that the House be to adjourn immediately.